government regains the trust of its citizens is by telling the truth. There is no other way, no shortcut.
And I call upon our government to open up like the Belgians have, the French have, the Brazilians have, the Argentines, the Mexicans have all released their files. It's about time now that we do the same thing and become a part of this planet.
It is way past time for all of us to know what our own government knows, instead of being kept in the dark by a policy of ditto.
The last time the Congress held a hearing addressing the extraterrestrial issue was 1968, 44 years of sightings ago. In those 4.5 decades, hundreds of thousands of new sightings have taken place. Government agency witnesses have come forward. Media coverage has expanded. Hundreds of documentaries have been produced. Thousands of books have been written. And yet the United States Congress has remained silent. So for a period of 5 days, at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., 2 blocks from the White House and 12 blocks from the Congress of the United States, we're going to conduct a citizen hearing on disclosure of an extraterrestrial presence engaging the human race. 40 to 50 witnesses of high rank and station, from military, from agencies, and possibly from intelligence services, along with the top researchers in the world, will give 30 hours of testimony to 5 former members of the United States Congress.
So maybe the citizens' hearing has a chance to try to leverage open some of the truth about the fact that we're not alone in this universe, that we might actually begin to look at what we really are, what the true history of this planet is, and that might be what gets us into a future without self-destruction.
The model of the citizen hearing is, if Congress won't do its job, the people will.
Greetings, everybody. Welcome to Galactic Roundtable, Countdown to Disclosure. I don't know where to begin today. I think I want to make a general statement. When we're talking about disclosure, there's been a lot of years of work gone into disclosure by a lot of people that have been working in a field where they get ridiculed, and folks that are very public with their putting out information about extraterrestrials and time travel and remote viewing and going to other planets and doing the kind of work that I do, have suffered a lot. They give up their incomes to do the work, which I did 3 years ago. I'm a registered nurse. I worked in the hospitals. I was an ICU nurse for, you know, a couple of decades. I made a lot of money, and I asked my family, you know, we're going to give up our income. I'm leaving nursing and I want to do this full time. And when you do that and you're successful at it, then you get threats. You live with, you know, physical threats on your life all the time. And I've gone through a lot of stuff, and nothing has ever made me waver in my work, because I want disclosure more than I want my whole life. And so, you know, sometimes I talk about this stuff. I don't like to talk about it. It's no big deal to me. It's just a fact of life. But it's worth saying once in a while. I'm not the only one. The people who have a real public voice on this face the same things. And many of the white knights have been killed. And people like me, we're not afraid of that. We're not afraid of anything. We're going to keep going and talking about this until we get this done. Lately, I've been approaching light workers who are posting messages that are false negative, leading the sheeple down the wrong path. And I've been asking them to clean up their act. And the worst part of it is that many of the people who follow my messages and check in every day on these other websites, really, folks aren't doing the work. They're still letting their ego minds run their lives. They are willing to argue a point to the death. They believe in the FEMA camps, and they believe in the Nazi SS, and they believe in all these false flag agendas, post them, repost them, regurgitate them, email them, forward them, and all these videos. This stuff is crap. And I'm embarrassed and ashamed that anyone who listens to me buys into that stuff. That's not what this is about. That's not what I sacrificed my life for. That's not what we're doing here. I need you to stop. So what I'd like to do on Countdown to Disclosure is talk about the facts, not conspiracy theories. These aren't theories. We have facts. And we can't cross the line where our lives merge with extraterrestrials on planet Earth until we deal with the truth. And what that means is we have to make commitments to changing the earth on our own. In the last, 10, 12 days, I've gotten 1,500 signatures on the White House petition. I should have 100,000 with no problems. But these haughty light workers with their blogs blogging all these conspiracy theories won't even mention the petition on their website. Some light workers who've been working for disclosure closely with Ashtar for decades, for like 50 years, won't even post anything about the citizens' hearing on their blog. If we can't get unity consciousness together within our small group, what are we doing here? What are we doing here? Why am I showing up every day making presentations? Why? Are you one of the ones sitting there who knows all these things that we need to move towards taking actions to change our world instead of just talking about it? And you haven't even signed the White House petition? Why do you think these witnesses sacrifice their lives to keep the truth? So they could come forward now. What are you doing in your daily life that's going to change this world? Posting false flags of fear on your website? Or maybe you're one of the ones who do nothing but sit there all day reading the false flags of fear, taking it into your body, blocking all evolution and change on the planet. I'm sick of you all. I'm serious. I had it. We can't keep doing this forever. We need to see change now. And it's not about the petition. It's about interrupting that rut that you're in and going out and taking action to change things and not being afraid to tell people what you really believe in. I want to share a message that I received from Lord Ashtar on Easter Sunday, March 31st. I shared this on the blog, but I haven't shared it on the radio yet. This is the real crux of the matter. I asked Ashtar to share with me the history of those of us living on planet Earth, so we could understand the connections with what's happening now with the disclosure movement. And this is what he had to say. Greetings, this is Ashtar. as you merge your local mind with divine mind, through the influx of higher light codes, upgrading your DNA strands, I have come to share information about Earth history. You are now prepared to understand the grand experiment on Earth. Earth history goes back aeons of time. There have been five Earths before, and we are entering the golden age under the sixth sun. We will go back as far as pre-Atlantis for the sake of this discussion. Nibiru has returned to the inner orbit of your solar system. Nibiru is the twin sun to your sun, Sol. Helios and Vesta are the solar logos in your solar system and spiritual parents of Sunanda Kumara. They, with Mother, Father, God, also known as Mother Sekhmet and Alcyone, make up your hierarchy at the Godhead. Alcyone is the great central sun in your solar system and is a stargate to source energy. The great central sun is an etheric sun, which is an etheric force working with source energy, and the etheric magnetic crystalline pulse, which holds all spheres in their place in space. Helios and Vesta are a reflection of this as the sun ascends along with the earth and all the planets in your solar system. These beings are delusional emanations, have descended to earth to work as extraterrestrial angelic council for the star seeds of earth. This grand experiment on earth is now ending, and every soul is facing Mother, Father, God as duality closes on Earth at the request of Gaia when nuclear weapons were deployed and the truth embargo began. Earth was colonized in this age by Lyrians and those from Dracos and those who had fallen from the old universe. Lyrians were Christed extraterrestrials evolved past needing a physical body. They created the dolphins and whales in Earth's seas as their first venture into physical bodies as a mammalian race. Their first colony on Earth was the beginning of the Atlantean civilization on Earth. The Syrians on the extraterrestrial angelic council made a bridge to prevent the Lyrians from being destroyed, mixing the DNA of the Dracos and Lyrians, hybrid mammalian and reptilian, to form new races of amphibians. These races have been spoken of in Hindu, Egyptian, and Greek pantheon of gods as part human and part divine, the gods. More and more Lyrians were tempted at this time to descend into physical bodies and therefore cause their own DNA to downgrade, becoming trapped and requiring salvation. The first colony on Earth of the Dracos was called Lemuria. It was because of this a certain segment of the galactic etheric angels agreed to incarnate into descendant bodies to help them from within the lower consciousness without losing themselves in the process. Many have incarnated now to end the grand experiment. These new species descended into 12 root races. The 13th is made up of galactic extraterrestrial hybrids who have agreed to incarnate into all 12 races, thereby making a new race, which is a combination of them all. By doing this, they have returned the grand experiment back to oneness. Over time, many colonized Earth, leaving the Great War on other stars. The Orion Confederation was made up of those from Rigel and Zeti Reticulans. The Pleiadian Council on Earth was made up of original refugees from Lyra to the Palladium system of 7 stars and 16 planets. The amphibian races on Earth fled and made bases under Earth's seas and live there today. Other races which had been brought to Earth as slaves were taken to inner Earth by the Christed extraterrestrials, and parts of that group were also taken to inner Mars, where they continue today. Earth and Mars were both colonized by the Lion People, and artificial landmarks of the Sphinx and and face on Mars when overlaid were the face of divine feminine in the form of Mother Sekhmet. The great white lions from on are working with Earth now as it ascends, opening new potentials for the planet of unity within diversity. As Atlantis continued on Earth, the Dracos and Lyrians, with the influence from the Sirians, Pleiadians, and those from Orion, all vying for power, became very dark, and this was their demise. Slave races were made, which were part animal, part insect, and part human. The Lemurians, too, altered their DNA and became part dinosaur, part dragon, and part human. The alteration in DNA made the reptilian brain part of the human makeup. More colonized to Earth, including the Arcturians, Antares, Tau Ceti, Procyon, and Sirius B. At this time, to protect themselves from negative forces, those in the inner galaxy formed the Galactic Federation. Alpha Centauri was part of the original formation of the Federation and is home to Commander Soltek. Cortan, who was also known as K-17, and his father Munkha, both from Mars, are now working to terraform the surface of Mars. The Galactic Federation, with the help of Soltek's ship, the Phoenix, link with the governors of the Lord Most High Council. They have been monitoring Earth's progress through the etheric city of Shambhala. Each soul is monitored, and their soul record from the Book of Life is recorded on the Akasha and may be recalled for review at any time. As each one passes in and out of the physical, the extraterrestrials and angelics work with these souls to prepare them for their next incarnation according to their soul record. Soltek relays through the technologies on his ship between Shambhala and the Watchers, or Lords Most High. These are all offices within the office of the Christ, and as we move up, positions are held by different souls throughout the ages. It is through the input from collective consciousness on Earth the next steps of the plan are put into place, including the DNA upgrades. Cortan and Munkha at Inner Mars worked through the ACIO on Earth with King of Swords and Tom the Ringtail Cat and others as a cosmic secret service, working with the councils to keep negative influences away from Mars and Earth, allowing them to continue with the plan. They have other roles as well. DNA is what imprisons one in a physical body, and that is why the soul requires salvation. To be raised up into the light body or the Merkaba body, DNA is programmed by the language of light and light codes, which are based on the law of one. The DNA is programmed to upgrade at time intervals, and this Easter is very special because we enter the ninth gateway of completion of the revelation of upgrades for the genetic code, returning all on Earth to their activated light bodies, freedom, liberation, nirvana, an end to duality on Earth, a completion of the grand experiment. You are returned to a Christ being, no matter what your origin. Those who refuse to return to love and the law of one will leave Earth now. Some beings simply have altered their DNA to a point which they are unable to remember love. The Draco's reptilians desired controlling Earth and accomplished this by incarnating into the most influential families on Earth. There are a group of scientists now on Earth working with this group who have withheld the scientific advances given to Earth by the Ashtar Command, such as nuclear fission, designed to upgrade intelligence on Earth, further keeping the races of man enslaved. Christed extraterrestrials work with nuclear fission in anti-gravity devices, but the dragons harnessed it as weapons for mass destruction. This has prevented Earth's galactic humans' consciousness from growing and violated universal law. it was this atrocity which allowed the Intergalactic Confederation of Worlds to intervene on Earth's behalf. The jurisdiction to uphold the law changed from the World Court to the Solar Tribunal. The Solar Tribunal is headed up by Lord Sananda's consort, Lady Master Nada. Scientists at NASA continue to withhold information about their manned flights, exploring the deep areas of space, utilizing a kind of propulsion technologies given to them by the negative extraterrestrials, making a megaton payload weigh only a few pounds and able to travel long distances in short periods of time. Earth astronauts in the NSA and other international space organizations, including NASA, explore deep space, and now civilian private astronauts are joining them. This is a breakaway society, and it keeps everyone else enslaved in ignorance. With the coming disclosure and announcements and enactment of Nasara law, Earth will be free. Accountability must be made between Earth citizens and those in the private, military, academia, courts, governments, and intelligence factions benefiting from the secret space program. The Ashtar Command stands by, working with the ground crew, coordinating events to unfold this final revelation. That, combined with the upgrade to your vehicles, lift you into the fifth dimension now. Etheric light cities are being built, and you will shuttle there above Earth and integrate them into the etheric living with the help of mentors and extraterrestrials returning to Earth to help in this, its next stage of development. This is the most glorious resurrection of Christed souls on Earth. Salute. This is Ashtar. I will see you on the Rainbow Bridge. So, I came with a kind of a stern message when I began today. And that's because I'm worried that if folks don't learn to get out of their ego, then I don't see how we're going to move forward. It's something to contemplate. If you're having an argument with someone, if you're fighting with someone, then you can be sure it's not your higher self talking, it's your ego, and that's how you know. Think about it, everybody. And if you're wasting your time with dark messages, I have no hope for you. None. Okay, we'll shift gears here. I had prepared a show, a program with another witness to the citizens' hearing, Jim Pensington, and his story is fascinating, and it was a follow-up of yesterday's program. However, I came across, you know, I started eating a meal, and I sat down, and I was listening to a different program, and it had such mind-bending information that's brand new that I haven't heard before that I decided to share that with you today instead. And this presentation is almost 3 hours long, and it's worth every minute. I've heard all but about 30 minutes of it. What this is a March 4th interview, March 4th, 2013 interview with Dr. Stephen Greer, and he's letting out details about his film that he hadn't shared before. If he had, I don't know where I was. And it's an interview on a radio program, and the DJ is apparently very fond of the F word, so if that word offends you, I hope you can withstand it, because the interview information is so good that if you can turn away from that little thing. I think he's very judicious with using that word, and I regret that. But he's, you know, he's a young kid, and I really would like to see this world change where I'd like us to be a slightly more civilized. What can I say? I kind of get tired of talking to you young men who have no reverence for anything. Anyways, I think this DJ's point of views are valid, and he isn't very intelligent. So, anyways, that's the one drawback of this piece, but I hope you won't let that deter you. Enjoy this, everybody. Hold on, I'm going to jump into it.
Welcome. One of the first things that I ever saw that made me really stop and think, there's a part of everybody that doesn't want to get duped. Right. And when it comes to a subject, especially an important subject like UFOs, there's a part of everybody that goes, you want to call bullshit right away because you don't want to be the last guy to call bullshit. You don't want to be the guy who believes, and it turns into bullshit. Oh, you dummy. You believed it. You were the first guy believing it, man. You want to be the first guy to call bullshit. It's always a way cooler position. And if there was alien life, that had visited the Earth, what evidence would they leave behind? What would you know in your day-to-day existence? How much of it would you know? Almost nothing.
Nothing. Particularly when it's getting hoovered up by a very well-organized and well-funded intelligence program.
Including the Project Blue Book, which was run by Dr. J. Allen Hynek, right?
Well, that was a cover story. The Project Blue Book was really a little office where they were putting things in there and making it sound like they were really investigating. Meanwhile, there was a unacknowledged project, what we call a black project, but the proper name is an unacknowledged special access project, or USAP. And the USAPs running this have been around since the 40s, very well funded, working on these issues, working on the technologies, studying how these things are going from one star system to another. And that's the sort of thing that we've been drilling down on for about 22 years.
So the Project Blue Book that was run by Dr. Hynek, is that was his name?
Yeah, Dr. J. Allen Hynek, right. He was an Air Force guy, astronomer that the Air Force engaged to do that. Later, he came out and admitted that was all just sort of a dog and pony show.
And he also became a huge UFO believer, which is really fascinating because most of the stories that they investigated in Project Blue Book, he sort of debunked.
Correct.
And in fact, instead of being open about the possibilities, they always steered towards debunking first.
Right. And actually the big problem became when he put his foot in his mouth when in Gerald Ford's home district in Michigan, there were a whole dozens of people who saw an extraterrestrial vehicle that was maneuvering at close range, and he went up and investigated and made some reference to it being swamp gas. And Gerald Ford went ballistic because his constituents went ballistic, and Gerald Ford actually had an inquiry into it while he was a member of the House of Representatives. Of course, later as president, he never dealt with this issue because basically presidential intelligence doesn't have access to those projects.
When you say that he said it was swamp gas, that J. Allen Hynek said it was swamp gas, so right. You're saying that Ford objected because he knew it was an extraterrestrial vehicle?
He knew that some of his constituents, who were very credible, knew it was something real.
What was his position then? What was he?
He was actually believed it was real.
In government. What is pre-president?
Yeah, he was in the House of Representatives in the Congress.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
He was a congressman before he was vice president and then president.
And so he was upset that they were saying that it wasn't a real vehicle. So he clamped down on it.
Yeah, and actually held a hearing where a lot of people came and gave evidence and information, but it didn't go anywhere because it's Washington. Nothing ever goes anywhere in Washington. And I started as founder of DisclosureProject.org and now SiriusDisclosure.com. We began investigating this in 1990. And, I'm a trauma doctor, emergency doctor, who was running a very busy ER and raising four kids. And I got involved with this because I knew about it since childhood. And, I have family. My mom's brother, uncle, was an engineer that worked on the lunar module. And I had an interest in this since I was a little child. So the thing that put Neil Armstrong on the moon, my family had a hand in that. So I think that what most people don't realize is that inside the intelligence community, the aerospace community, there are a lot of people who are very knowledgeable about this, but they're not allowed to talk about it. It's a career ender for most of them. And that was what we did for Disclosure Project, was to put all those folks together, identify them. So I spent about 10 years identifying who these people were. First, I had maybe half a dozen of them. Now we have over 550.
Who are the most credible people? Just so folks listening to this that haven't watched that video, who are the most credible people?
Well, we're going to have some of them in the film, Sirius. You know, there's like S-I-R-I-U-S. Sirius is going to have a lot of this information in it, and some stuff is going to blow your mind, including the possibility of an actual body, a humanoid body that we're investigating. And we'll get into this in a moment. And when you see it, you're going to go, really? My God. But, you know, these witnesses that we have who are military go from the head of investigations for the FAA, John Callahan, to people like Gordon Cooper, who was one of the early Mercury astronauts, who his crew actually filmed one of these extraterrestrial vehicles landing on a dry lake bed out here near Edwards, and he looked at the film and sent it on a Pentagon plane. Now, the backstory to this, will give you an idea of how labyrinthine and screwed up Washington's become, and what Eisenhower said when he said, beware the military-industrial complex, because it's going to get out of control and be a threat to our democracy. Gordon Cooper, you know, a very heroic early astronaut, had detailed information, what we call actionable intelligence, on that event, this landing of a vehicle in broad daylight near Edwards Air Force Base in 1956. Now, when Clinton was president, Gordon Cooper was asked by the Secretary of Defense, William Cohen, about this issue. And he says, yes, I absolutely will verify this, and I'll give you the information when and where and how it happened. So the Secretary of Defense of the United States of America had this information, made an inquiry through channels, and came up with a dry hole. Basically, this stuff has all been put into a parallel universe that the senior people in our government have, for the most part, no access to. Now, I would not have believed that if I hadn't been the guy who was brought to Washington during the Clinton years to do the briefing for the CIA director. And I was asked to go up there as a service, and I did it, left my ER. And I put together a whole lot of these early witnesses' testimony, photographs, some really amazing government documents that we acquired, some through channels I don't want to talk about. And I put this briefing together. And so I go up there, and here's the sitting CIA director, R. James Woolsey, and his wife was there, who was at the time the chief operating officer of the National Academy of Sciences. And when I was first invited to go up there and brief the CIA director, I was told, they want you to come up here because President Clinton and he have inquired about this subject and are being denied access. I have a letter proving this.
President Clinton has been denied access, so they right. want you, a doctor,
who had a family connection to these programs and also to information.
And so, how did they know about you?
Well, let me finish this other thread, sure, and I'll get please. To that, because that'll blow your mind even more. But what happened is that I really thought this was crap. Uh-huh. I mean, because his handler, the CIA director's handler who contacted me said, look, they need you to come up here because they can't find out anything, but they know stuff's going on. Well, I thought they just wanted to pick my brain as sort of spooks, you know, how spooks will, as spies sure. will try to just get information. I went up there and the CIA director was honestly completely in the dark and I was mortified. And towards the end of this almost 3-hour briefing that I did for the CIA director, my wife was with me and I gave him this white paper, this position paper that a summary of action that the president needed to take and he needed to take. And my hands were shaking because, you know, I'm like this 35-year-old guy briefing the sitting CIA director. It was very intimidating, frankly. And, you know, at the end of it, I said, you know, we really need you to help disclose this information because the people need to know, but also the technologies that we've studied and have mastered for 50 years could get us off oil. We could fix this environment. We could fix the world's poverty problems and the geopolitical problems in the Middle East. And he looked at me, he says, how do we disclose that which we have no access to? And I just thought, I thought I'd pass out. I said, what do you mean you have no access? And this was from his mouth to my ears. And so I learned the hard way, the very, very hard way, that when you're dealing with things that are, some people say above top secret, but the proper name is an unacknowledged special access project. And we have about $100 to $200 billion a year in our treasury going into these rogue operations. And it's a criminal. It's outrageous. That, you know, just because you're the CIA director, just because you're Secretary of Defense or on the Senate Intelligence Committee means nothing. And even the president. So the reason those folks invited me to come up there is that the year before, I had taken a team of people out on a beach using some experimental protocols to contact these vehicles and the occupants. And four of these UFOs popped into the sky, just boom, 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 which we have on videotape. Not great videotape because we didn't have good cameras back then. And there were a couple Air Force officers and pilots there. And this went up through the chain of command. A few months later, the former head of Army Intelligence invites me to a meeting, and then some National Security Agency people do, and one thing leads to another, and I'm being invited to brief the sitting CIA director.
So
that's, you know,
how did you contacted these spaceships?
Well, this gets into a discussion when, you know, that's complex, but yes, and...
You can do that at any time?
Well, not at any time, but I think that under the right...
You can do that.
There are protocols, and we developed something called the Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind Initiative, which is when you use a set of very controversial protocols that deal with non-locality, the fact that the universe has various dimensions that you can move through to go from one star system to another. But those dimensions that are at higher resonant fields than, say, linear space-time or electromagnetism, also interface with what I call coherent thought. So the Moody Blues were right when they said thinking is the best way to travel. And there's a component to where, you know, this, I'm probably going to lose half your listeners right now.
No, you won't. I've got freaks listening.
All right, well, okay, all you freaks, listen up and listen up hard. You can develop technologies, and we have these in classified projects now, where you can have what's called a switch that will interface with very intent thought. So it's beyond, forget your iPhone. Now, if you're traveling from one star system to another, that's what you're going to be using. You're going to be using technologies that are phasing at multiples of the speed of light. And those dimensions also intersect at a certain point with coherent thought, just like light is coherent, a laser is coherent light. And so this gets into the whole question of how over the history of humanity have there been so many reports of contact, and there are. I mean, going all the way back to the Vimanas and the Vedas to accounts that, you know, there's a wonderful painting in the Middle Ages of this exactly, it looks like a modern UFO over the shoulder of Mary holding Jesus in a picture. It's from the 1400s. I've actually seen the original of this. So I think the question becomes, you know, we probably have always had extraterrestrial civilizations observing our little planet. The question is, what happened in the last 50 to 100 years that really got their attention? And I'm quite convinced it's when we started detonating thermonuclear weapons. But one of the projects we're involved with is Disclosure Project. Another one is sort of a citizens' diplomacy effort saying, look, since our government is dead in the water on this in terms of the Secretary of State and folks like that, and I know I went up to the UN and met with back when Boutros-Ghali was UN Secretary General, and briefed these guys, and Leah Ghali, the wife of the Secretary General, and I talked about this in depth, and she said, they're not going to let us deal with something like this. So I started a citizens' diplomacy effort back in 1990. But this is actually, and this is the part that I get ridiculed the most for, but it's the reason why the intelligence community took it most seriously, is that they knew that we had discovered the Rosetta Stone of contact. And they were very concerned. Now, concerned from the covert end, from the end of a lot of these Washington operatives, they were just fascinated. They didn't understand it, but it was sort of past their scientific understanding. But they were very interested.
This is something I hate to interrupt you.
No, please.
This is something that we can't really just gloss over. The idea that coherent thought, as you say, intersects with these other levels, these other dimensions that we can't normally access.
Correct.
How did you find out about this, and how did you develop the ability to
You're putting me in the hot seat early, man.
Well, you have to. When you say that you can do that, I mean, somehow or another, you have to, without getting anybody killed, you have to explain. How'd you figure that out?
I figured it out when I was a teenager. Through a series of experiences I had. And, you know, I was talking to Thomas Jane, who's an actor here in town, about this. And I had a near-death experience when I was 17. I was very sick. And I had an experience that took me into some awareness about the nature of consciousness and the non-locality of mind. And the fact that the mind is actually a singularity, that there's really only one mind. and it's just shining through various individuals appearing as many. And this experience, although it sounds very spiritual and religious, was very palpable. And I was raised a very devout atheist, so we didn't believe in anything. And so when I realized that this was real, I began to study meditation. And through that, began to have some experiences where I realized this could happen. And I had a contact experience. I was 18, it was a few months later, in the fall of 1973. And I was doing this. I was meditating, and then I was doing what's now called SRV, scientific remote viewing, where you use consciousness to see remote places. And, of course, Army intelligence and the CIA have experimented with this for years, which you may or may not know about. We can get into that. But I know all those guys. I know all the SRV people. But I was a kid, you know, and I just turned 18. I was doing this, and suddenly I had this experience where I thought, well, what if I try to go into that state of one mind that I experienced when I was a kid, six months earlier when I had this near-death experience? So I did. And then I had an experience where I remote viewed and saw deep space and could see that there was an ET spacecraft out there. And I made contact. And it appeared, and it literally materialized right near the mountain where I was.
How old were you when you did this?
18.
No drugs?
No, I've never done any drugs, actually.
You've never done any drugs?
No.
No psychedelics, nothing?
Never.
Wow.
No.
Are you aware of dimethyltryptamine? Do you know what that is?
Yeah, I do.
You know, it's supposedly your brain produces it when you're in periods of extreme stress or near-death experiences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's also the same chemical that's in ayahuasca, which has been used by indigenous tribes to...
Right. No, this was just, this was a very natural sort of thing that happened.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is that these people that are having these experiences, that are having, a lot of people that are having alien contact experiences, they are all having them in the middle of the night. Like, most of them are having them at night. And I'm not discounting this in any way. In fact, I may be possibly enhancing the possibility of people understanding this, or the vehicle. The mind produces this dimethyltryptamine during REM sleep. And it's believed. So it's still a very sketchy thing. We know that the body produces it. We know they believe the pineal gland, which is literally your third eye, and reptiles, it has a retina and a cornea and a lens. They believe that's what, but the evidence on it apparently is like really kind of, it's hard to figure out exactly. But they know the body has it. They know it's produced by the liver and the lungs for sure. And this chemical, when you get it and you give it to people that have had UFO abduction experiences, it gives them the exact same experience. It brings them into contact with other beings. The idea that this is just a hallucination because your body has some endogenous chemical in it, and it spikes and stimulates the visual cortex and what have you, and you have this that is what everyone has always assumed whenever you talk about anything hallucinatory or psychedelic. What they're not – what a lot of people haven't taken into consideration is that you're basically a conglomeration of chemicals. Your neurotransmitters, dopamine, serotonin, there's a million different chemicals which, as their levels vary up and down, it drastically changes your reality. Your happiness level, your appreciation, love, oxytocin, all these things proven 100% change your reality. Change the physical meat vehicle reality that you have. And I think for whatever reason, when we think of something in the mind, when we think of the mind, like you're saying that coherent thought can contact other entities from other places. People are like, what the fuck are you talking about? You know, that's like the initial immediate reaction.
Right.
Okay, everybody. So this guy, Joe Rogan, obviously has done a lot of research on this DMT chemical. This, back in the 60s, they used to call this the businessman's high, because you could leave your office building at lunchtime at noon, go walk down into the park, take a hit of this drug, sit on the grass, do a meditation. It would go into your system very quickly, and you would have an out-of-body experience. But it would come out of your system very quickly, and you'd be completely back to normal a half hour later. You eat your bologna sandwich and go back to work. Kids today look to DMT. They want to use it so they can have these out-of-body experiences. And You know, it works. It's an artificial source. But it's the exactly same thing that happens for anyone who's meditating and goes out of body. And so the whole goal is that you have to meditate. And the reason why is the reason you can't depend on a drug to get the experience as a shortcut. You know, these kids are using this as a shortcut to meditation because they don't have the discipline to do the meditating. And so if anyone is ever wanting to connect with coherent thought and travel wherever they want to travel, you won't get there unless you start meditating. So if meditating is too irritating for you and you can't get rid of the chatter in your mind, you're not holding out a hope for anything. You're not going anywhere. You're going to spin your wheels until your body decays and you end up in a coffin in the ground. You have to start meditating. You have to. Stephen Greer is saying he has a technology that turns a switch and connects you with coherent thought. I can do all of that without any technology. I can call in the ships from whatever spot I'm on and see them in the sky. I do it through meditation. This is how all the rishis connect with their ships too. You have to start meditating. You can't just use a drug like he's talking about here and have your experiences. You're not going to go anywhere with your spiritual evolvement, and you're not going to connect with coherent thought because you won't even know what that is.
Because we've all been miseducated about the nature of reality.
Of consciousness itself. Conscious reality. I've always tried to get people to try to understand how bizarre just imagination is. And right. I don't mean imagination by you're imagining things that aren't there. That's not real. You're playing a game with your mind. What I mean by imagination is everything, including the language that we're speaking with right now, the vehicle in which this language is getting delivered through the internet, all of this came from the imagination.
Right.
Everything. This table came from the imagination.
Sure. Everything.
The arm that holds this microphone. Someone thought this shit up, and then all of a sudden it manifested itself in a physical form when they actively created it. That seems so normal to us. It seems so normal. But we're the only fucking animal in the world we know that can do this.
Well, and it goes beyond that because, you know, Dr. John at Princeton University had the Princeton Engineering Anomalies Research Lab, and I knew Dr. John, and they had proven that you could set up a random number generator machine and put your thought towards it and begin to move, whether it's spitting out zeros or ones, and that there is, in fact, been proven scientifically that the mind is actually operating non-locally, meaning that it's not limited to space and time in a linear way. And these studies that have been done by Dean Radin and Dr. John and many other scientists with very good credentials. I mean, Dr. John was an engineer in Princeton. What they found is that, in fact, the mind itself is what Erwin Schrödinger said. And Erwin Schrödinger, of course, was the father of particle wave theory and quantum mechanics. And I think it was in 1910 or so, he said the total number of minds in the universe is one. That is, it's a singularity. And so that understanding is, I mean, I know it sounds sort of out there.
Hippie.
But no, I mean, it actually sounds very Vedic in the sense of Buddhist or Vedanta. But
hippie
I guess to maybe Sarah Palin. But did I say that? I'm sorry. I apologize. But the reality is the world isn't flat. And there's a whole area of physics and science that has been drilled down on for years that establish all these things as true. It isn't talked about because the high priests of religion and the high priests of science are all opposed to this information coming out.
So
part of the secrecy around this whole UFO issue isn't just the physical energy and propulsion systems. It's the paradigm. Because if you ask the question, in fact, going back to this dinner with the CIA director and his wife, very smart lady, and she turns in, we're sitting across the table having dinner. I mean, that was the cover story, it was a dinner. And she says, how are they communicating across the vastness of space? And of course, I had the, you know, I didn't know whether to tell her something that sounded scientific, so I maintained my credibility, or to tell her the truth and risk losing all my credibility. But I decided then, in the early days of this project, that if someone's smart enough to ask the question, I'm going to answer it honestly, even though it's going to blow their mind. And so I looked at her, and her husband, the CIA director sitting next to me, didn't really understand where she was going. I said, look, take our Milky Way. It's 100,000 light years across. All right. So that 100,000 light years is a distance. That's how far you would go at 186,000 miles a second for 100,000 years going at that speed. That's just our own galaxy. Now, you take 1% of that, say 1,000 light years, at the speed of your cell phone or radio wave or TV wave or this system we're using right here, for someone from a star system 1% of the way through our galaxy, for them to say, hello, how are you? And for a spacecraft that's at another star system 1,000 light years away, say here, Earth, to say, fine, how are you doing? That just took how long?
4,000 years.
2,000 years. 1,000 one way and 1,000 another. So the time since the birth of Christ. So the speed of light is too damn slow. And so when you begin to go through what I call the crossing point of light, it's like the sound barrier was a big deal. The biggest deal is the light barrier. And when you go past the light barrier, you're going to cross into these kind of multiphasic resonant dimensions, part of which hook into the singularity of mind and thought. And actually, this film that we're working on, which is the largest crowdfunded documentary in history, to my knowledge, Sirius. And you can find out about it at SiriusDisclosure.com. It's been crowdfunded by the public. It's all been funded by people out there, thousands of people. We're going to do a premiere here in L.A. on April 22nd, if you want to come. But
I would love to.
Okay, come.
Well, we can't send things to the speed of light, right? I mean, even saying that.
Beyond the speed of light.
But they can't do that, right? I mean, you can't send information in the form of light yet, can you?
No, but fiber optics and things of this sort.
But does that move at the speed of light?
Pretty much.
Yeah?
But okay. but what I'm saying is that if you go beyond the speed of light,
right,
it's a whole new physics.
Of course.
Okay, so that's what, if these craft are here, and now I have over 4,000 cases where they've landed, and we have evidence. I have 3,500 pilot cases. We have over 500 whistleblowers, top secret military corporate people, and I have 110 of them on digital videotape, although nobody really wants to see it, but I have it. So the question is, if they're here, how the hell they get here?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they're not using an Exxon Jet A fuel, and they're not using a solid rocket booster, and they're not using an ion drive or anything linear. So you have to begin to have this question. So when the CIA director's wife asked me this, I told her about that they had technologies that interface with thought and consciousness. And that sounded may sound as bizarre to people now, but if you took your cell phone and showed Thomas Jefferson your smartphone, they would think it was magic. If you went to Salem, Massachusetts a couple hundred years ago, you'd be burned at the stake as a witch.
Yeah,
so the point is that people have to have some humility about the fact that humans are one half of one step out of the jungle, mm-hmm, technologically. I mean, we're only 100 or so years into anything resembling real technology. So when we're dealing with civilizations that are 10 to the 6th, 10 to the 7th, 100,000 to a million years ahead of us, we have to have some humility about what that might look like. And so when I explained this to the wife of the CIA director, she just looked at me and said, I thought it had to be something like that. I mean, people are ready to actually understand this. Not everyone has to be retarded on this. And I tell folks that what's a shame in my mind is that our civilization has been exploring these sort of what they call borderland sciences for 100 years. And it's all been kept very secret or debunked or ridiculed. And it's actually holding us back, not only socially, spiritually, but environmentally and in every other way. Because this nexus of where you have these advanced trans-dimensional physics come together, that's how you're propelling through one point in space to another across galaxies. It's also how we're going to be able to run this planet's energy grid without a grid, where every home, business, and car can pull energy out of the fabric of space-time through this kind of physics. And so there's this nexus where electromagnetism and transdimensional physics comes together, and then you cross a little deeper, and that's where you get into the science of consciousness. And this becomes a very, very complex issue for most people because it's new to them. But once you understand the fundamental science behind it, it's really very simple.
What we need to understand is that no one 200 years ago even thought of a camera.
Right.
200 years ago, when you want to picture something, you had to draw it. And there was, you know, the idea of a camera was so, the idea of a movie, the idea of sending a video on your phone to your friend, you could take a video of you here right now and send it to a friend, and they would get it almost instantly. That's just a tiny blip in human history, a 200-year blip in human history from riding horses to sending video through the internet.
100 years, yeah.
And, I mean, and the people that existed back then would have never seen it coming, and if technology, and we know it does, accelerates exponentially, what we're dealing with 1,000 years from now, 10,000 years from now, is completely unrecognizable. We live in an area where our solar system is kind of scary. There's a lot of rocks out there, and they fly around, and occasionally slam into shit, and they can ruin civilization for a little bit.
Right.
But there might be solar systems out there where that doesn't take place. There could be a civilization that developed 2-3 billion years ago. I mean, we really don't know. We have no idea.
Well, the Earth has had life for 700 million years, and all scientists recognize that, except people who think that the world was made 6,000 years ago. And I have nothing to say to those folks except to say, get over it. But I know I'm an outrageous person.
You are a little outrageous.
A little bit outrageous. You haven't heard anything yet.
You're on the edge.
Yeah.
I'm ready. I'm strapped in.
So, but if you really look at our technological development, you know, my grandmother was born in post-Reconstruction South in the late 1800s. Her son worked on the lunar module, put the first man on the moon. But by the time we landed on the moon in 1969, we were 15 years into having classified anti-gravity propulsion devices.
The biggest mindfuck that I always try to drop on people with time is between the invention of the airplane, it was less than 50 years that someone used that airplane to drop a nuclear weapon.
Right. And see, this is
pretty crazy.
This gets into the whole question. You know, I've had a lot of people ask me. We have and if you go to our site, seriousdisclosure.com, there's a section that has all these top secret military guys on it. And part of it is that there's a whole grouping of them. I have a dozen of them or so who are at strategic air command facilities and nuclear weapon storage areas and processing areas and all this stuff. And every one of them were overflown by ET spacecraft back in the 40s, 50s, 60s, because they were very concerned about what we were doing. Because we were going from having these technologies to weaponizing them, and our technological development had gotten ahead of our social and spiritual development.
Way ahead.
And this is an existential threat. But, you know, as an emergency doctor, I used to have, you know, crazy people come into the ER, and I'd have to commit them. And, you know, it's dangerous to yourself or others. And what I found is that if you take a step back and look at humanity through the eyes of extraterrestrial civilizations, we've become dangerous to ourselves, but we're also dangerous to others. And moreover, we become an existential threat to the biosphere of the Earth, where we're killing the oceans, the atmosphere, and everything else. All this is unnecessary. So the question is, the misanthropic sociopaths that are running the planet into the ground are going to have to be stood down by the people getting behind disclosure, getting behind the technologies, and basically saying, we're fed up and we're not going to put up with this anymore. It's like the movie Network. And we're mad as hell. And I think people, it isn't about doing anything violent. It's about saying, we need to just move forward because Washington isn't going to do it. My uncle's company, Northrop Grumman, isn't. Lockheed Martin isn't going to do it. It's you and me and the other people out there who get the situation we're in and want to fix it.
One of the things that might have also got their attention was Operation Starfish Prime. Are you aware of that from 1962 where they launched a nuclear bomb into space? blew up a nuclear bomb in space.
Well,
of all the things I've read and all the things I've studied, I never heard this one. There's a lot of things today in this interview that I never heard. A lot of things I did hear, but several of them I didn't. And I figured maybe if I didn't, maybe you haven't either. And that's why I'm putting up with this swearing DJ. Joe, if you're out there, I don't approve. Just letting you know, you know, I'm a mom. What can I say? Sorry, I'm not more hip. I just don't think it's nice.
Actually, one of our witnesses, Colonel Diedrichson, was with the Atomic Energy Commission, which became the DOE, and he was an Air Force colonel. And his responsibility was over all the nuclear facilities, but he knew of a program where we were going to lob a thermonuclear weapon and detonate it on the moon. And when that, okay, and they actually worked on this, and when it went exo-atmospheric, when it left our atmosphere, and it was intercepted by an extraterrestrial vehicle and basically dematerialized, was taken out. And he knew, had personal knowledge of this. So,
so they had actually tried to do this.
They actually launched it, and it was on its way to the moon. You know, there have been a lot of really crazy, it's like Dr. Strangelove on steroids with some of these guys. And, you know, I still work with a lot of folks who are with the agency and aerospace industry. And there's a term at the Naval Research Labs and CIA for this whole area of science, and it's called WSFM. It stands for, it's not a radio station, by the way. It stands for Weird Science and Frickin' Magic. And that's what they call it. And
you're a grown man. You should never use the word frickin'.
Yeah, I don't. This is what they call it.
They need to be stopped. If they have that access to technology and they're using the word frickin', you can't be trusting them.
Yeah. Oh, you can't.
They're held back.
Actually, I'll tell you, a lot of them are really good people who want to see the secrecy end.
But there's not much they can do. As an individual, when you're in a compartmentalized sort of a system like that.
Well, I got a lot of them come forward. You know, almost all of our top secret guys had signed security oaths. Uh-huh. But here's something I want everyone to listen carefully. Daniel Sheehan, who is a constitutional attorney who did Pentagon Papers and Silkwood case and all this, and I ran this by him. I said, look, I've done briefings for, here's a short list, the Director of Central Intelligence, the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, members of the Senate Intelligence Committee, senior people who are on the House, various House committees, Government Oversight Committee, presidential staff, the head of intelligence for the Joint Chiefs of Staff, what's called J2, personally. I took astronaut Edgar Mitchell to one of those briefings for the Admiral, Admiral Tom Wilson. And every one of these people had been inquiring about this issue and had been denied access. One of them, who I will not name, I learned before my briefing with him, I had given a document that's going to be in this film series. And the document is on the front of the thing, the briefing I put together for President Obama. And if you go down the list...
You put together a briefing for President Obama?
Yeah.
They asked you to?
Someone senior involved with his team did. And so...
Jesus Christ. How weird must that be, to be the president? And then to get in there and go, okay, what the fuck is going on with
UFOs? Yeah, the emperor has no clothes.
Hey, call that doctor. What's that guy's name?
Yeah.
Virginia, Dr. Greer? Go get that guy.
Yeah. Wow. So, no, but what happened is that when this admiral looked at this document, and it's going to blow people's mind when they see this, it's a National Reconnaissance Office document. NRO does all the top secret spy satellites. And over their headquarters, it says, we own the night. And the – oh, yeah, that's their motto. We own the night.
It's pretty awesome.
Yeah, it's pretty spooky. Yeah. But so, you know, these are the kind of dudes I work with all the time. What happened is that one of these compartments, it has a whole distribution list, cosmic ops, magic ops, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, all kinds of, it's about 20 of them. And this is a document that was not declassified, that was given to me by a source that I won't talk about. And this admiral recognized one of those compartments, so he contacted them. And on the other end of the phone, he said, look, I'm so-and-so, and they said, yes, sir, we know who you are. And he says, well, I want to be read into, which is military speak for briefed, on this project. And they said, sir, we cannot discuss this project with you. You don't have a need to know. He says, what do you mean? I'm the head of intelligence for the Joint Chiefs of Staff. How can I not have a need to know? And they said, sir, we will not discuss this with you. Click, blocked him.
So who the fuck knows? Who's like, how many people are there? Have you determined that?
Yeah. I have. I know some of the members of there's a committee, and it's transnational. It started out much smaller and less opaque back in the 40s when Truman was around.
Does it have a name?
It did have the name Majestic, and that is not a myth. And so
it was Majestic 12, right? Is that what it was?
Yes, but the document as of the 90s that I got still had Magic, MAJIC on it.
Uh-huh.
And so a lot of these programs, you know, they've gone through multiple generations of evolution. And now, I understand, it's a committee of 200 or 300 folks who are, you know, corporate, very deep, kind of shadow government operations. And the mistake the public makes is that they think that just because you're the president or the CIA director or a member of the Senate Intelligence Committee, you're going to have access to those. And that's because they do not understand what Rumsfeld said is true on the day before 9/11. And this is going to be in the film, where he said there's $2.3 trillion basically missing that we can't account for out of the Department of Defense budget over the last few years. $2.3 trillion, not billion. Now, we found out, and I discovered this in the early 90s, that there's somewhere between 100 and 200 billion a year basically just being stolen going into these illegal projects. And so when Sheehan and I looked at this, this attorney, I said, look, if all these people who have a need to know in the constitutional chain of command are being lied to, deceived, and what have you, I'm going to declare all those projects rogue.
This is very important what he's going to say next. I just want to say, I had written an article about these billions of dollars that are stolen every year and go into the secret space program. And I explained where the money comes from. Canada passed a law for their trade agreement, which funnels money out of Canada into Israel. And Israel, you know, is a corporation. It's traded on the SEC. It's registered on the SEC. You can look it up. Corporation of the United States, Corporation of Israel, working together with Canada being their money launderer. This is how they get the money out of the country. And no one is looking at this. And I can't even get more than 1,500 signatures on a petition to change it. And I'm really worried, you guys. Now listen up to what Steve's going to say next.
A priori, illegal. Therefore, anyone who signed a security oath for them, I'm going to unilaterally announce that they're released from them. So all of you listening, if you've been in any of these projects with Lockheed, Northrop, SAIC, the CIA, you do not have to go by the secrecy. Because if they are denying access to the people who are in the constitutional chain of command, which I can prove they have in a court of law, those projects are rogue, and therefore those security oaths have no enforceability. Now, whether or not you have the courage to come forward is another question. But what I was very glad to be able to do between the early 90s and 2001 with the Disclosure Project is to pull together the people who did have the courage. And they're still coming forward. When we have people contact me all the time who are in these projects, who give us information, intelligence, and it's really a citizen's effort. I mean, I've never been in the government my entire life, but I think this is what you have an idea, and if the idea picks up steam and people see the reason for it. But the other thing is to do it in a way where people feel supported. And that's why we did this in a way where there were dozens that came out at once. I mean, I think in the initial batch of people came forward, it was about 70.
One of the things I always want to get into people's heads when they start talking about the government or the people in charge or, you know, those in the know, the idea that they're exchanging information is been proven false time and time again.
Right.
Not only that, what's really blown me away lately is finding out that especially in this supposed patriotic time of war, we have government factions that don't like other government factions.
It's always been that way.
I was blown away when Petraeus was outed by the FBI. I'd be like, are you fucking crazy?
Right.
Like, that is nuts. You're talking about the head of the CIA, and the FBI is spying on him over an affair, and you're going to bring down this beloved national hero.
Right. Stupid.
That, unbelievably stupid.
There's a different story to that story, you know, about Petraeus. That he's beloved is a myth. And the atrocities he committed in the war in Afghanistan will be prosecuted. And he was not thrown out over an affair. And it had nothing to do with the FBI. You guys can't keep, you know, processing these negative stories through your minds every day and believe everything you hear. because it's holding you down from connecting with coherent thought. And I'm really worried where we're going. I don't want to get through the month of April with all this cool stuff unfolding and still be having arguments with young people who, some old people too, who are staying stuck in the rut and aren't doing any self-discovery. It's frightening what you're buying into out there. I'm worried for you.
But also unbelievably revealing about how partitioned our government truly is and how difficult it would be to get access to some critical information if this information is in any way deemed too sensitive or too controversial or too paradigm shifting for average eyes.
Well, let's make this very simple. If you acknowledge that the UFOs are there and they're real, and anyone with an IQ over mud is going to ask the question, then how did they get here? If you ask that question, we have the answers for it. And if the public knows that, then they know we don't need ExxonMobil. We don't need oil, gas, coal, nuclear power, or a centralized utility grid.
But that's assuming, though, that most people believe that the UFOs are real. Because
yeah,
I don't,
about 50 to 60% do now.
I think they say that. I think they say 50, well, when they, but when I think they most of the time will look for terrestrial explanations, most rational people.
Well, no, actually, there was just a poll that came out a month ago, and there's actually 43% of the public believe that extraterrestrial life has been on the planet, and it's here now.
51% believe that the Earth is less than 10,000 years old. Did you know that?
Yeah, well, I don't know if it's that high. I heard it was about a quarter of the population. So,
Gallup poll, I think 2010, they got 51%.
The Flat Earth Society still has a lot of members, I guess. But you know, here's the bigger issue: is that if you bring this information out, and let's say that one of the objectives of what I'm working on now.
I mean, let me just clear that up. Yeah, 46%.
Okay.
Creationist view of human origins, 46%.
Well, but of the creationist view, not all those people think right. The world is 10,000 years old. Yeah. I think that number is only about
10,000 15%. Years, though. They're saying 10,000 years. This is what, in this study, the Gallup study, very specifically, 46% of Americans believe the creationist view that God created humans in their present form at a time within the last 10,000 years.
Oh, God, you're going to make me move to North.
Anyway, Canada's a good choice, dude. Canada's right there, and they're badass.
I know.
Just, hey, you know, just to throw some salt on your idea that
yeah,
it makes
sense.
Please
throw all you want.
I mean, look, I told you that I'm a huge fan of the UFO experience. I mean, I really want it to be real, but just because 47% or whatever the fuck think 46% think that the Earth
right.
is less.
No, you're right. Yeah, and but the evidence speaks for itself. And I told someone once,
but does it? Does it? I mean, what yes. percentage? Okay, let's just be honest, or rather, let's open this. What percentage of UFO sightings are real? What percentage are totally made up, and what percentage are a confusion?
But that's not the metric we're using. We're going by government released documents. We're going by people who are insiders who have actually handled extraterrestrial
right.
bodies.
So when you're talking about experiences, you're talking about experiences from people who are 100% credible, bulletproof, eyewitness
testimony. Yeah. I mean, and only that, but if you have the former Minister of Defense of Canada mm-hmm. say that he checked out with a U.S. Air Force general, that in fact there was an accident that happened in New Mexico in 1947, which people call Roswell,
mm-hmm.
and that what Colonel Corso wrote in his book the day after Roswell was substantially correct. And this is the Honorable Paul Hellyer, and he and I did a press conference in Toronto a couple of years ago, and he has completely verified this. So the question is, and then the same thing happened with five-star Admiral Lord Hill Norton. I mean, here he was the Minister of Defense, and he found out after the fact that, in fact, an extraterrestrial vehicle had landed at the Bentwaters Royal Air Force Base at Rendlesham Forest in England. And we have multiple Disclosure Project witnesses who were there. And it came out recently that the Ministry of Defense in Great Britain released the documents on that where they had physical evidence that this thing actually did land
mm-hmm.
And left physical traces, et cetera, and so on. So I tell people, you know, usually the New York Times say, well, we need two or three corroborating witnesses to something, particularly, and three, if it's a very controversial story. I say yes, but the Disclosure Project has hundreds of these sort of people, thousands of cases like this, and we're not talking about just people
right,
seeing something in the sky.
Right, but witnesses per event. They don't mean, like, overall.
Yeah, but we have multiple ones for this landing at Rendlesham Fort. We have multiple ones from the Minot, North Dakota event.
How many do you have?
Where there will be
the
some of them, you know, four, five, six at one event.
And they are
very credible
story.
Military people. Mm-hmm. And so why isn't the mainstream news, reporting this if you put together this amount of information? And then the question becomes, how free is our media? And how free is our market? And how free is our country? Because I think there's more corruption than people can imagine. And I'm not a conspiracy theory person.
A minute. Yes, you are.
No, I'm not.
How dare you?
No,
how
I'm
dare
not.
You? I'm not. But just be honest.
I just don't like theories.
Okay. You're a conspiracy
person.
But you're dealing about UFO conspiracies.
Well, it's like, was the mafia conspiracy of a criminal enterprise? Yes, but
yes.
It's not a theory. It's a fact.
Okay.
And
so
there's a big difference between.
Obviously, you're talking about a UFO conspiracy, an energy conspiracy. You're talking about the suppressing information.
People conspire in their own interests, and if you're
so, I don't know. I know you don't like conspiracy theorists, but okay.
Well, no,
conspiracy
I just don't. I think the term
believer?
Is used. I think it's misused.
I think it's misused, and
I think that just
weighted. It's loaded.
It's
right?
a loaded thing.
Yes.
And it's like, it's like when Larry King asked me, do you believe? I said, well, I believe in a lot of things that you can't see and prove. But if I have 4,000 cases where these things have landed, if I have hundreds of photographs and videotapes, if I have dozens of top secret guys who can corroborate this, why is that a belief? I mean, you believe in God and some other things. But, I mean, this is not a matter of belief.
Most people believe, and I'll quote Neil deGrasse Tyson, who says that eyewitness testimony is the least reliable of all pieces of evidence.
That's right.
But what physical evidence do you have that goes along with eyewitness testimony that you believe is the most compelling?
Well, I think the most compelling that I've ever seen is something we're working on right now. And it remains to be seen if it's going to be what we think it is, and we're going to know fairly soon. And I don't want to get ahead of myself, but I was introduced to an institute that acquired a small humanoid being, about 6 inches in length.
This is in the trailer for Sirius. I've seen this little skeleton that's x-rayed.
And CAT scanned, and we're now doing the genetic work up at the top university in the world that's doing this.
Pull that up, Ryan, because it's very freaky. People on Ustream and Vimeo can see this. Let's just play the entire trailer for you and get people excited about this movie. Now, who found this alien being, and where did they acquire this thing?
It was, I'm not at liberty.
Okay.
I'm still waiting to see if this person was, but it's an...
Because it might be horseshit, right? It's a possibility.
All I'm saying is that it is an organic being.
It is an organic being.
It is. The CAT scan shows lungs on the inside. It has 10 ribs and not 12. We have now proven from bone density that it's at least several years old, and it's only 6 inches long. So the team...
How do you prove that from bone density?
You look at the epiphyseal plates and the calcium. In other words,
right, but
if
that's
isn't
it? Why you're dealing with a completely alien species?
No. I'm saying if you were to go back, if you're going to assume that it's not ET, then you look at it. What would this be if it were human?
I see what you're saying.
Okay, so you have to go through an algorithm and it's a diagnosis of exclusion, we could say in medicine, because if it's not a miscarried or aborted fetus, which is the size of what this would be, about 22 weeks, if it's not any known primate. It's not a fossil because it has organic material and DNA material. We've already extracted. We clipped two of the ribs, and have gotten the DNA material out of the rib of internal marrow. And so this is being processed right now as we speak, literally.
So if it was a human, it would be several years old. So that proves that it's not a human.
There is no form of dwarfism or any other genetic anomaly known in the literature. According to the world's expert in this area, that would explain something of this age that is this, and also that has these abnormalities. If you look at the skull, if you look at the fact that it has 10 ribs, there are no genetic syndromes where you have 10 ribs.
Have you seen this thing in person?
I was the third person to hold it and handle it. did the, I didn't say autopsy on it, but I did the tests on it.
And how long had it been dead for?
We have no idea.
No idea.
That we didn't get enough material from. We didn't want to damage this little thing too much. So the carbon dating on it will be the next step. We wanted to be sure we had enough genetic material, and if we had to go back, we didn't want to destroy. Anyway, so we're working a scientific algorithm on this. This is actually the people, the public, who are supporting the film Sirius are the reason why we were able to do all these studies.
How is this thing preserved?
You know, it was found in a very, very dry desert area, and it's just very desiccated. It's very dried out, and it was not in any sort of preservative. And now it died a traumatic death. We know it behind the right mastoid air cell, behind your ear here, the skull is crashed in, and it's a little asymmetric on the jaw, and the right humerus is fractured through and through. And it happened at mortem or shortly post-mortem. We think it was the fatal blow to this particular being. Now, what is this being? When you look at it, almost every scientist that has seen it goes, looks like an ET. But we don't know. All I'm going to say is that we're not going to be able to say, because, you know, even the genetics, there's no database to compare it to. Now, we have the whole human genome to compare it to, which is what we're doing. Mm-hmm. And we have all the literature that the world's expert in skeletal abnormalities, the expert in the world, looked at this thing and said, this is nothing that I know of and that has ever been seen on this planet. And so the question then becomes, what is it? Now, it turns out it was found in an area of the Atacama Desert in Chile that Native peoples have reports of these objects, luminous objects, going in and out of the foothills of the Andes.
Famous for
very
UFO
famous
sightings.
Yes, very famous. And also in these remote Native villages, there are reports of these very small beings, upright humanoid-type beings.
Isn't that also the area where they constructed the VLT telescopic array? One of the very large telescope, I believe.
I think there are, yeah, because it's a very dark area, and there have been a lot of astronomy. And we also know one of our witnesses who was manning a facility on the Peruvian-Bolivian border that's not too far from this area was there in the early 90s when we were using a SDI Star Wars system to track ET craft and hit them with electromagnetic pulse weapons. And one was downed and crashed on the Peruvian-Bolivian border.
We hit it with electromagnetic pulse weapons.
Yeah, this is
so. Who did this? The Air Force, the Army? Like, do we know?
Yeah, we know, but I mean, it's this group Majestic. Uh-huh. But I mean, you know, if you were to talk to the general I briefed, who's head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, which is almost as big as the CIA that's in the Pentagon, he'd know anything about this. So you know, when you say who's doing it, it's not. It's kind of almost not the correct even way of framing it is to say, when Senator Inouye. He just passed away, wonderful senator from Hawaii. You know, he said, there exists a secret government with its own Air Force, its own funding mechanism, its own Navy. I'm quoting almost exactly. And actually, this is a great speech by this senator. And it's because he had run across that this was going on. So the question is, who's running this? Well, they've gone off the reservation. There's certainly no congressional oversight or presidential oversight over these rogue elements. And I think that is a threat to our democracy, but it's also a threat to our security in the world. If what we've learned is true from multiple military insiders, that we have been attempting to target these extraterrestrial vehicles and down them, how stupid is that? You're dealing with civilizations that could turn the Earth into a pink mist floating through space in a nanosecond, and we're there firing at them. Why? You know, I mean,
you're convinced that this happened? Absolutely.
I absolutely know it has. Because I have too many insiders who've been present. We've done this sort of weaponization of electromagnetic signals.
What about disinformation?
Most of the information out there is disinformation.
Right.
I would say
do you believe any of it's ever hit you? Like any of this might be disinformation?
Oh, yeah. Not when I'm telling you.
No.
Have I ever been caught flat-footed? Yeah, almost. We're very careful. And I have to say, you know, as a doctor who got into this sort of accidentally, and then I was tutored and mentored by some really good people in the military and in the intelligence community who wanted me to do this, And one of them is still at the CIA. He's a PhD guy. And he says, you know, someone needs to do this because the politicians are never going to deal with it. And these big corporations are absolutely not going to let it out. And this was back in the 90s. And I said, well, what am I supposed to do? And, yeah, one of the interesting things, after we put this briefing together for Clinton and, you know, Lawrence Rockefeller, I put the concept together, the best available evidence, and all these cases. And then Lawrence Rockefeller hosted Bill and Hillary Clinton at the Rockefeller Ranch and it had me out there shortly before that. And Mr. Rockefeller was the white hat in the family who wanted to end the secrecy, unlike some of his family. And so he said to me one night, I was out on his porch on deck in the Grand Tetons at the JY Ranch, and he said, we really need you to hurry up and do this. And I said, oh, Lawrence, I'm just a doctor in North Carolina working in an ER, you know. He says, no, you have to do it. I said, no, Lawrence, you have to get these guys to do it. He says, they will never do it. And I said, Lawrence, for God's sake, you're old, you're rich, and you're a Rockefeller. He says, no. He says, the implications of this are so vast and so profound that no aspect of life will be unchanged when it comes out. I said, yes, Lawrence, that's why it's secret. And then he said to me, well, that means those folks aren't going to do it. And then, you know, before that, shortly after that, and I had this meeting with the CIA director, and one of the president's friends came to my house, and this was a very disturbing story. I'm sitting at the table with my four kids, four daughters, and this man, who's very close friends with the president, Clinton, says to me, well, you know, they're very supportive of what you've recommended in this white paper. I said, great. He says, but they're not going to do it. I said, why not? He says, they're convinced that if the president steps into this too hard, he'll end up like Jack Kennedy. And I started laughing, thinking, what a load of nonsense. And he stopped me. He says, no, they're serious. I said, well, don't say this in front of the kids. So we went to the library in my house after dinner. And I said, what are you talking about, Kevin? And he said, they really think this is too dangerous. I said, well, what am I supposed to do? What am I, chopped liver? And he looked at me and he says, yeah, you're expendable. So I have always viewed myself as the kind of the throwaway guy in all of this. These guys, you know, the folks who have enormous political power and corporate power, even the ones who support this very avidly, and there's a lot of them, they don't want to stick their necks out.
But I'm confused. Okay, why would they kill Bill Clinton if Bill Clinton came out and said that we may have evidence that there might be some intelligent life out there in the world, universe?
Because, you know, it's like the REM song, it's the end of the world as we know it. Because when that happens...
People would panic.
No. The public isn't going to panic over this unless it's couched in a stupid way.
Well, the public definitely will panic if the president comes out and says there's UFOs and then he gets whacked. Mm. That would lead to panic.
Yeah, but there's a bigger problem. If the president doesn't have control access over these projects, he didn't want to talk about it because then it shows the fact that our democracy has been sidelined, as Eisenhower warned us. I mean, Eisenhower was not anti-military. He was a five-star general.
For folks who don't know the story, just fill people in on the speech that he made an active sitting president leaving.
Yeah, the last day of his presidency, he basically said, beware the military-industrial complex. And this is...
the dangers.
And he said the dangers of this enormous power will be a threat to our democracy and our way of life. Now, the reason he said that is that between 1954... and 1960, 61, when he was leaving office, it was on his watch that the military-industrial complex reorganized under the Rockefeller Commission of 1956, and Eisenhower lost complete control over these projects. I have a lieutenant colonel who was on the plane with Jack Kennedy flying to Berlin when he gave the I Am a Berliner speech. And Jack Kennedy was talking about this UFO issue, but he turned to this guy who was kind of the chief steward for Air Force One, who I know. And he said, I know about this, but the whole matter, is the President Kennedy saying this, the whole matter is out of my hands and I don't know why. And this guy was stunned. In fact, I'll tell you, this is kind of a gruff colonel, Air Force guy who was crying as he told the story, because it hit him that there had been sort of a silent coup d'etat on this issue. And one of the problems in Washington when I meet with people who are part of powerful committees and politicians is that, they're kind of viewed as placeholders that come and go. The mainstream media is really bread and circus, where they just keep wanting people to be entertained with shock and dribble. The question becomes, how are you going to get this story out? And that's why, I mean, a few years ago I left medicine, which was a hard thing for me to do. Because, I mean, I really love taking care of, real emergencies and trauma.
How long did you do that for?
I was in that ER 10 years. And I was chairman of emergency medicine. And, the problem became for me, the world's in an emergency. So I said, I'm an emergency doctor and I know an emergency when I see one. And we're in deep trouble. And so someone has to do this. But before I did that, what you have to understand is I went to everyone I could. I mean, I went to these powerful people. I went to the UN. I went to the British government, the Ministry of Defense. And basically, none of them doubted this was all true, frankly. This is what people need to understand. There was no laughter in the room. They took it very seriously. But they didn't want to stick their necks out. And a friend of mine who's a big business guy, he said, well, the way the world works now, everyone wants to be first to be second. It's something tough.
I've always felt that something along the lines of alien contact, if they did have information, there's no reason to let people know unless it's unavoidable. I always felt like unless they were just going to try to do some damage control and redefine what's happening, I wouldn't think that they would ever come out about it. It just doesn't seem like it would be something that would be advantageous to just start telling people about UFOs. The idea is always that the government is our daddy and that our government's looking out for us. But
right.
The evidence points time and time again to that that's horseshit and that's not really what's going on.
But, my military advisor made the point years ago that because so many people, between 5 and 10% of the public have seen one of these objects, many of them very close range.
Let's get back to that. Because this is what we had talked about before when we got onto this, people who think the Earth is 10,000 years old. I think most of what people see is bullshit. I think most,
no question about that.
Most sightings. I did a show once for CBS called Game Show in My Head, and it was a hidden camera game show where we put an earpiece in people's head, and we were sending them out onto the street, and they didn't know what they had to do until they got there. And one of them, we said, okay, see that camera over there? That works for you. There was a big news camera. You're a news reporter. Mm-hmm. And there was just a UFO sighting right above Hollywood Boulevard. The problem is the witness took off. So you need to grab someone who wasn't there and have them become a witness. Tell them exactly what you need to tell them to get them to do this. Get them to lie on camera. Then you need to get them to tell you that they were abducted and probed. And I'm serious. And we got people to do it like that.
Easy. No, I have no doubt. But
people are full of shit.
Yeah, you can. You can always do that. But I'm talking about
high-level military.
And the residual. I mean, for example, we have multiple pilots for commercial airlines and the Air Force. And this is one of the really great cases we have, by the way, the Japan Airlines case over Alaska in the 80s. And the guy who was in charge of investigations for the FAA, who was third from the top during the Reagan era, he actually left that agency and brought the originals with him and gave them to us of the radar tracings of this thing that was the size of like 10 747s moving in a nonlinear way over the skies. It was on civilian radar, which was on military radar. They scrambled F-16 jets. It was on their radar, and the Japan Airlines 747 pilot has testified to it, and we have all of that in this case.
I've heard of this.
So when we brought all that forward, and this guy came forward, he says, I'm one of these high-level government officials who actually has seen all this and has handled it, but no one's asking the right questions. So when you pull all that together, and then, of course, there will be events like this thing that happened in Phoenix, where eventually the governor of Arizona, Fife Symington, came out later. I mean, at the time, he ridiculed it. Mm-hmm. But he had actually seen it, came out later, 10 years later, in 2007, said, yeah, that was an ET craft, almost certainly. And I saw it, and tens of thousands of people in the Phoenix area saw it. And it was photographed, and it was on radar, and there were very trained people. So, you have to ask the question, how many things like that have to happen? And, on the other hand, the things that we have in physics that are inferred through indirect measurements, like black holes, are articles of belief and faith, or even the Big Bang Theory. But when you have all of this, and this is not just someone on Hollywood Boulevard who's making stuff up, we have dozens, thousands of people, you have radar cases, you have all this. And so a lot of this is what's going to be in the film, Sirius. And because what I've said to people is that the fact that people haven't seen this evidence doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. It does exist.
I agree with you.
There are a lot of people who will see things, and it'll be a planet rising, mm-hmm. or it'll be a meteor, or it'll be
military aircraft,
a satellite, yeah. or it'll be a. Now, this is the other part of this. There are a lot of things that are UFO sightings that are very legit. And that's why I don't like the word UFO. There are two categories of UFOs that once you eliminate all the nonsense you're talking about, mm-hmm. and there are the ones that are ETVs, which is what they're called, NSA, extraterrestrial vehicles. And then there are the ones that are the electromagnetic devices we've been building since the 50s. And if people think that propulsion and energy systems stopped in the 40s, they need to think about this. Let's step back for a minute. Your car is running on an internal combustion engine circa 80.
Mine is because I'm a man, okay, and I don't drive a fucking sissy hybrid vehicle.
Yeah, there you go.
I'm not driving a Prius that makes no noise.
Yeah, you should have a 1,000 horsepower electric one, and then you'd really have some power.
It's too futuristic, man. I need Led Zeppelin on the radio. I need a little 1970s in my life.
Yeah. Well, no, but I mean, this, you know, and the jet engine, people think that was, we're flying around on jets, so I came out here from DC. Mm. That's 1930s.
Right.
Rockets, 1940s, Wernher von Braun. Mm-hmm. Do people really think there have been no breakthroughs in energy, physics, and propulsion
since the
40s? Well,
sure, people absolutely know that we've been working on things like that. But to bring up what you brought up earlier about the governor of Phoenix, just to point out that the governor the governor of Alaska, Sarah Palin, is one of those people that believe the Earth is less than 10,000 years old. So just because you're a governor or something doesn't mean you're on the ball. And second of all, I had friends that were in Phoenix, and one of them, very credible guy, told me he saw some giant black triangle flying motionless over the sky. He said it was bigger than several football fields. He said it made no noise, and it blocked out the stars. And flew over. And he said everyone in his neighborhood was shitting their pants. There was enough to me that I would go, wow, there's something. There's too many people that saw something.
Sure.
You could attribute certain things to mass hysteria, but that was one of them that I found to be very strange. But I never heard any photographs. You say photographs.
Oh, we have amazing photographs and videos. They're going to be in the film, Sirius.
You don't have them anywhere else that anybody see online? You're holding them back?
No. They're out there. Dr. Lynn Katai, who's a medical doctor, also took some of them. There's other video.
Photos of the Phoenix crafts.
Yes, the actual one. Yes.
So what should we – if we want to look for one right now to put in this show right now, we're online, who does he look for?
I guess you'd go to Dr. Lynn Katai's site. I don't have it memorized.
Spell her name?
K-I-T-A-I.
K-I-T-A-I.
Yeah.
Pull that up, Brian, see what images
she has
you get
quite
on Google.
In there. Yeah.
I've never heard that there's been photographs of these things.
Yeah.
What does the photo show?
It shows exactly what people described, a formation of lights that were moving together in a massive sort of bee formation.
Right, and the government said that those were flares.
Right, because a couple hours later, when they couldn't contain the news story on this, I was there when this happened, by the way.
You were in Phoenix?
I was there.
Did you see it?
Yeah.
What did you see?
What you just described.
Now you, when
now, why was I there?
Why
that's
were you there?
Another. Yeah.
Did you get your spider call? The Batman, whatever fucking the thing, a UFO just appears over your house like the bat sign. Remember when he's in trouble? We need to send Batman. Is that what they did?
Right. No, they don't. I was actually there at a digital lab that was being loaned to us to put together. To put together the best photos and videos to give to Congress that I was briefing in April of 97. So in March of 97, I had gone there, and there was a guy who had a digital laboratory who said, look, we'll let you use our old equipment and assemble this. We'll help you. And he'd worked a lot with the military. And so I had collected photos and videos from all over the world and governments from all over the world, which we call the best available evidence. I was putting it together because in April, we were holding a closed briefing for members of Congress who wanted to know. And that's when people like Congressman Dan Burton, who was chairman of the House Government Reform and Oversight Committee, came, and a whole lot of other people from the Pentagon and vice president's office and whatnot. So I was there when that happened, and someone came running into the lab saying, my God, while we're here trying, there's this going on. And it turned out it was on the news that night in Phoenix. Now, interestingly, the national news didn't pick up on it until June. This happened in March, which is very interesting. They Why did that get held back? But, it, you know, and so there are so many people who saw it, and this was huge, whatever this object was. It was not the size of like a 747. A 747, you know, you probably could put dozens of them inside the volume of this thing. It was huge.
I found it interesting that the stories were very similar. It's one of the things that I found most interesting. I watched some stuff online, and then when I spoke to my friend who lives in Phoenix, and he told me what he saw, I was like, wow, you're talking about like at least six or seven people that are telling the exact same story of seeing this exact same sort of thing. Now, these are the images that you're talking about. These are the whatever the red lights that are in the sky. I think the video is probably more impressive, being that the video shows these things essentially hover for a long period of time. And much longer than really should be attributable to parachutes and flares. Doesn't really make any sense, because parachutes and flares, they don't really move that slow. When you watch a guy jump out of a plane with a parachute, the parachutes, you know, they drop, they slow your fall down, but yeah, they don't make you suspend.
There's a good photograph of it. No, and yeah. And we know how those kind of flares occur. But the people who were directly under it, and it moved not just over this part of Phoenix, it moved all the way from outside Flagstaff through the valley and then down towards Tempe.
Now, how did you know about it? You were there working. Did you hear about it?
There's a guy that ran into the lab and who had actually been in the military. He said, "You wouldn't believe what's going on." So, I was there that night. And
what year was this?
1997, March of 97. Yeah, now, what's equally interesting, if you look at this, now the Belgian Air Force cooperated with me very, very nicely. Back in the early 90s and late 80s, you may have remembered there was this wave of things that happened in eastern Belgium, where there were these massive triangles that were about 800 feet on each side that were photographed, radar traced, chased by F-16s, and we have all this. And the head of the Belgian Air Force actually showed the radar of one of these objects going from hover to several thousand miles per hour straight up into space, way outside the envelope of any normal conventional propulsion system.
They have a video of this.
Radar of it. And we have this. So, you know, the question becomes, how many of these cases do you need to have before you say there's something out there?
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is the problem is that on this subject, the ridicule around it and the disinformation and the crazy stories that are out there is what dominates. Mm-hmm. The serious, pun intended perhaps, the serious stuff really gets left on the cutting room floor by most movie directors and media, and even on the internet. It's very hard. And I think to pick your way through is very difficult. What I've tried to do, and it's not that I've done a perfect job of it, I've done the best I can with a lot of help. But remember, we've never been funded. We're all volunteer effort.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we've tried to do is get people who have the really good stuff from governments come forward and share it. And this is why, you know, when the Space Agency of France released a lot of their documents after I was having some meetings in France and with some of the seniors.
You can't say it both ways. It's either France or France.
Yes.
You got to pick.
It was France when I was there. And when it's here, it's France.
There you go.
And, you know, there's an admiral that works with us in France, who's a wonderful guy. And he's an MD and a PhD and an admiral. And you know, he knows all this is very real. And so eventually the French government really, I believe it was about 100,000 pages of documents on all of this. And now, since the Disclosure Project launched it 10 or 12 years ago, there are 14 countries who've opened up their files. Now, of course, the United States isn't, because the United States is managed differently on this issue. It's a compartmented, unacknowledged special.
And the former Soviet Union has actually been pretty open more recently in more recent times about the possibility.
When it first fell apart, not so much now, but when it first fell apart, we have a great dossier of KGB cases and files, and also military. And in fact, some of the cosmonauts that had encounters with these. I pulled together in 1995 for a meeting with some of our astronauts, like Edgar Mitchell, to have a meeting out here in California. So, you know, there are some really solid cases out of the Soviet Union.
Does Edgar Mitchell claim to have had a personal experience?
No. He's just investigated it and has concluded that this is all very real. And he did come with me. I invited him to the briefing we set up for the head of intelligence for the Joint Chiefs of Staff at the Pentagon. I think it was very interesting for him to have learned that the people at that level were shaken to their foundations because they concluded this was all real. But when they made inquiries, they were being lied to and denied access. And so this brings up this question: who's running this show, and who's over? Who the foxes are guarding the hen house? And this is exactly goes back to Eisenhower's warning. But you know, we're 50 years into that era now, and so half a century later, as big of a screw up as it was in 1961 when Eisenhower warned us about it, it's 10 times worse than that now. And so much so that I have concluded that the way we change the dynamic on this is that the people will lead, the leaders will have to follow. We do the disclosure. We bring out these technologies. We set up teams to make contact, and we just bypass the government.
The evidence that you have, this alien life, before that, this is a more recent thing. This is fairly recent, right? Before that, what was the most compelling piece of physical evidence that you've ever encountered?
I would have to say that it's these really well-documented, complex cases that involve documents, radar cases with photographs, and multiple corroborating, credible witnesses, such as
pilots.
What about
landing sites?
I actually have been given materials from where the sites have landed. They're very anomalous. A great case that's in the French files that they released in the Japan, what's it called, Japan, this the space agency like NASA, release was the Provence case of 1981, I believe, when one of these objects landed in a lavender field, of all places.
Must have smelled awesome.
Yeah. Well, it was a commercial lavender farm, and so cool. And it was wee hours in the morning, and this thing lands. The farmer comes out, and it's this disc-shaped craft.
How large?
I think it was in the 50-foot diameter range. And there were these little beings outside picking lavender. Now, this sounds crazy, like some out of science fiction.
Like how little? Like your little guy?
No, these were, from what I remember, like 4 feet, 5 feet, that range. And then, it left this spot where it had landed, and there were anomalies, electromagnetic sort of radiation into the soil. And this was actually studied by the French government, concluded to be an absolutely real case, just like the Bentwaters Royal Air Force base case in England was determined to be an authentic case of a landing. So these sort of landing cases that have also now, at the time, there weren't many people coming forward. Now we have all these military people coming forward, corroborating. They were there, they saw this, and now the documents are getting released from the UK and France. But in the United States, it's still a black hole.
Now, we're going to play your trailer for the upcoming film series. You got it pulled up, Brian?
Yep.
Is it cued all the way through?
And here we sit, 2012. With the world still burning oil and gas and coal, when we have had all the information we need to have had a completely new civilization.
Dr. Stephen Greer is absolutely a hero.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
You know, hundreds of billions of dollars, the public would be a little annoyed.
All right, sit down and shut up.
I was told to pray, not to meditate. I was told to talk, not to listen. I'm learning to listen.
The primary purpose is to train people to understand these other civilizations and their cultures.
I don't give a goddamn what anybody else says about it. I saw that.
Who do you tell without them looking at you like you ain't wrapped too tight?
And I was a part of the United States Air Force cover-up for 18 years.
What we are attempting to achieve is a device which defeats the perpendicular force of gravity.
When we look at our data, we lost 7% of weight.
We now have the technology to take ET home.
Consciousness is at once the most familiar thing to us and the most mysterious.
It doesn't take much effort.
you just clear your mind.
People are afraid of looking at technology.
Paul Brown's stuff got basically suppressed for many years.
He got murdered.
The problem is not proving that UFOs exist. It's when you begin to expose the energy and propulsion system behind how they're getting here.
They should push them in the center and you too.
All right.
What? Where is it? What?
That little thing freaked me out.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I don't mean to sound callous, but being a, you know, doctor, I've seen so many worse things. But it's actually fascinating. Well,
that's fascinating. I mean, it freaked me out. Not that it's a dead body. I've seen dead things. It freaked me out that that might be a life form. By the way,
was a life form. We know for a fact it was a life form. What it was is what we're investigating. And I think that, you know, one of our witnesses who was on a retrieval team of retrieving extraterrestrial bodies from craft that we had targeted, you know, has talked about the fact that there are many different species that have been cataloged over the years. And at one point, I think it was in the late 60s, there were like 68 or 69 or something in that range. If you look at space and look at the stars, probably every stable star system has planets around it they're discovering. And there's the likelihood that there's an enormous diversity of life out there is a statistical certainty. Even the conventional astronomers and the Drake formula will support that. The question is, you know, have they gotten here? Well, you know, most probably wouldn't be able to, just like we weren't for thousands and thousands of years. But there's such hubris to think that, you know, we're at the pinnacle of technology on Earth in 2013. We're not. I think that, you know, when you begin to look at the progression of technology once you reach a breakout point, as we have in the last century here, in fact, most of the big breakthroughs in technologies, no one knows about. They exist, but they're in a classified project. And that's, I think, a bigger story than the ET story, is the fact that there is a cabal of, as I said, sociopathic, misanthropic folks who have decided their macroeconomic grip on power needs to be maintained through this sort of ruthless secrecy, and where they keep from the public this information, not because they think people are going to hurl themselves off the Brooklyn Bridge because we're not alone in the universe, but because when this comes out and this information comes out, it means that the sciences already exist so that we can get off oil and gas and coal. And you know what? A Goldman Sachs guy said, that's a $600 trillion nut you're cracking right there, trillion. And because if you look at all the oil in the ground, the coal in the ground, the commodities trading, the petrodollar system, the utilities, the internal combustion engine.
Hey, everybody, don't you get tired of paying a heating bill every month, a cooling bill every month, knowing that the free technology is right there for us to use? But, you know, that alone is worth disclosure. But I can't get more than 1,500 signatures on a little petition. You know, people just can't give it the time of day. And I'm really worried, everybody. I'm really worried.
All of that is defunct, extinct stuff, or should be. And so here we are cannibalizing this planet for no good reason, except that there's a handful of folks. And you look at the sort of centralization of wealth and power there is in the world now. It's the most extreme it's ever been in human history right now, right this minute, this instant. So, you know, there's 200 to 300 individuals and corporations that have over half the net worth of the world.
You know the guy in the beginning of your video that says that you're a genius? David Wilcock. Do you know who that guy is?
Oh, yes, I know who he is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do you know that he also thinks that he's Edgar Cayce reincarnated? He shows you pictures of
I have
Edgar
no
Cayce,
idea. That's news to me.
Edgar Cayce's friends and how his friends look like Edgar Cayce's friends. And
really?
Have you ever watched any of that guy's lectures?
No, I haven't.
Yeah.
I mean, some of the team interviewed him, but I don't know.
Might want to do a little editing with that one. Not saying that anything else in your documentary is bullshit, but that guy makes my radar detector go off.
What most people don't know about David Wilcock is that he worked on the Montauk Project. And the team of people who worked on the Montauk Project opened up rifts in the space-time continuum that allowed the time-traveling war criminals, intergalactic war criminals, to enter this timeline and commit these crimes. I believe everything I've heard from Stephen Greer, but I don't believe that he doesn't know that the claims David makes about looking like Edgar Cayce and being Edgar Cayce and all that jazz. Might want to do a little editing there.
The evidence that this technology has been suppressed, is there evidence that like this free energy technology has been?
Yes, there's a huge amount of evidence, and
do you reveal this in this documentary?
Yes, there's a whole document trail, and one of the things we got some years ago was a demand from the Department of Defense to the FBI that they turn over the secret papers of Nikola Tesla that were stolen, and we have this document, and you know, what happened to them? And what were they trying to hide? The Federation of American Scientists, a very big mainstream organization in Washington that has a national security research project associated with the Federation of American Scientists, came out about 2 years ago with a report that there were 5,135 patents that had been seized under the National Security Act, and that some of these things were energy-related. One of them, in 1971, was only a solar photovoltaic generator. You know, we're from sunlight to electricity, photovoltaic, that was more than 20% efficient. Now, you can't even get that now, but meaning that it was probably like 40, 50% turning sunlight directly into electricity, and it had a national security order slapped on it. And this mainstream scientific group says, how could that be a threat to national security? It would have been a threat to the domination of oil and coal and the petrodollar system. So, you know, this is not a conspiracy theory. Mm-hmm. There are entities that have conspired. And you look at the wealth and power behind these entities. I mean, people have been killed for a lot less than this.
It really is. That is such a loaded word, that conspiracy. It's unfortunate that it's necessary to use because it's been so co-opted.
Well, I think it's really more about special interests and cartels always acting in their interest. And if you've got the power, you're going to use it.
And
you know
what?
And here's the problem. If the people allow it to happen, and I was just reading an article in the New Republic about this, that if you, whether you're, you know, letting Saddam Hussein or the Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi or whatever it is, or you have to give them that power. We give the power to the government. Ultimately, by our passivity. And so ultimately, I'm not one of these people who runs around saying, oh, well, you know, there are these boogeymen that are doing everything and we're just hapless creatures. If we're allowing it, if we're not part of the solution, we're part of the problem. If we're allowing it by our inaction and passivity because we want to be bread and circus people sitting around eating, you know, Cheetos and watching Jay Leno, which is fine. But if that's all we're doing and we're not trying to fix this problem, then, you know, obviously the passivity of the public and our politicians who don't want to risk their career or danger in that power vacuum, you're going to have these sort of people step. And I think there's a power vacuum that existed for a little while after World War II that gave an entry to these folks. And I think that it will continue for as long as we let them do it.
I think it's pretty obvious when you look at the fact that this is the age of information, where information is being distributed more freely and more easily than ever before.
Right.
Yet this is also the age where the government is continuing to attack the Bill of Rights, continuing to slowly but surely restrict our rights and civil liberties, and make it so that if they deem you a threat to the nation in any way, shape, or form, they can essentially detain you. They don't have to do anything illegal. They don't have to contact your family. This is all stuff that's being passed now, and that seems to me to point to the fact that they're looking at this. Where's it going? If you look at it on a graph, if you project the future, well, it's going towards some ultimate free information space. And if it gets to that, then it's going to be revealed exactly how much fuckery's been going on for all these decades, and how much craziness has been going on behind the scenes.
It's going to come to a point in time where the government's going to have to be accountable for where all the money goes every year in tax dollars. And right now they're not. You give them your tax dollars, you don't get a receipt, you don't know what the fuck happens. There's a congressional budget meetings, and the Senate, you know, gets together, and the president puts out his plan, and the financial people get involved. But how much access do we actually have as to where your Dr. Stephen Greer's financial records or your tax dollars go? Almost nothing.
Oh, we don't know. And you know, even the folks who I know an auditor for the federal government who audits Northrop Grumman, and he said one of the problems is that once you get to a compartmented project that's eyes only and it's unacknowledged, they're not going to tell you anything. They won't even acknowledge it exists. So how is there any check and balance on that?
It's essentially a dictatorship.
Yeah.
When it gets to that, really, you're essentially dealing with a dictatorship. It's just dressed up as a democracy, but their ability to act is completely they have total impunity. They can do whatever the fuck they want. They don't have to listen to you.
If we let them. And here's the other problem with that, you know, is that the macroeconomic system, you know, we're supposed to be a free market economy. Well, how free can the market be if there have been decades of confiscation and suppression of these advanced trans-dimensional energy devices and these so-called over-unity free energy devices? And if that's going on, it completely lays to waste the whole concept of a free market. So, yeah, it's a free market if you want to tinker around the edges and come out with an iPhone 5 instead of an iPhone 4 or, you know, whatever version of this and that.
Right.
But let's not forget that your computer that you think is so cool, you're charging it off a grid that's a 1800s coal-fired power grid for the most part. And so, you know, we really have to wake up to the fact that our society has been held back, retarded, really seriously by this kind of secrecy. And so this secrecy is actually becoming a threat to our continued, not just our liberty, but is an existential threat to the planet. And moreover, it keeps forcing all these unintended consequences where we stay encamped in the Middle East. And, you know, the buzzword in Washington, because of our vital national security interests. Well, right. That's code for oil. Just forget the BS. That means oil. Because you say, well, what about Israel? Israel has 200 or 300 nuclear weapons. And Damon, I lived there for 3 years. Believe me when I tell you, they can take care of this. I mean, you know, if there's an existential threat to Israel, you know, they can handle it. They don't need Big Brother America there.
But don't they? I mean, don't they get a tremendous amount of funding from us? Weapons?
Oh, they get funding, but I'm just saying we don't. That's not the reason we're in all those vast areas of the Middle East. It's because of the oil interests.
Of course. Yeah.
And you know, and this becomes a question of why? Well, because if you have a device that would fit on the table here, that run your house when you don't have to be on the grid, or your car, put in the boot of your car, and you have an enormous amount of power. Electric.
How would that work?
Those are called zero-point or quantum vacuum electromagnetic generators. And basically, through very high-voltage systems, you create a vector into this baseline energy field that it really holds the universe together. And, you know, they start talking about the Higgs field and the negative energy of the matter of the universe. But for years, it's been proven that the zero-point energy field exists through what's called the Casimir effect. And I'll get into the arcana of the physics of it. But this was published in mainstream journals. The question is, how do you tap it? And can you? The answer is yes, and it has been. But they keep suppressing scientists and inventors who come up with it. There's a man that I know who worked at Lawrence Berkeley Labs, and he was using a coiled array around a barium titanate crystal and using very high voltages with a certain hertz, certain pulses, he was able to get 10 times more energy out than was going in because the crystalline structure was tapping into this zero-point energy field that is in the fabric of space and time. So there's an enormous amount of power. It's been estimated that every cubic centimeter of space, not outer space, but space in this room, has enough energy to run the Earth for a day if you could tap it. So the question becomes, if you can do that, you're not going to need to have your car filled up at a gas station or a utility to Con Ed or whoever it is. And those sort of interests have trumped the technical ones. The technological issues, I believe, can be fixed. It's the strategic issue that's the problem.
I'm going to stop you because I need to know about this experiment. Where was this taking place? Is this peer-reviewed? Is this something that has been...
It was confiscated. The man that had this happen... a physicist,
mm-hmm.
And some goons broke into his lab, broke it up at the experiment, and basically took him and put him in a mental hospital for a while.
Where did this happen?
Lawrence Berkeley Labs in the 80s.
Okay, so...
70s or 80s.
Do we know exactly what he did? And is it reproducible?
Yep, I think it
is. So why has no one reproduced this? It doesn't make any sense.
Because you have to have a whole lot of specialized equipment to do it right. And people have tried. Here's getting to the reason we're doing this film. Mm-hmm. Is that 100% of the proceeds from it are going to go in to build a new energy lab. So all this stuff that we've collected can be done. I think with the intelligence we've gathered in between 1 and 2 years, we will come out with at least a generation 1.0 of these energy systems. Because I have thousands of pages of documents on this and many, many physicists who've worked in these programs. But you've got to have a properly equipped lab. You've got to have security. You've got to have the whole world watching. And this would not be a secret project like the Skunk Works at Lockheed. This would be, it'd be like this, it'd be streamed. So all the work going on in that lab, the whole world's watching.
Okay, so...
Right, because I don't think you can do this secretively.
How come you know about this story? How come you know about this experiment, tapping into zero-point energy, but this is not common knowledge amongst nuclear physicists? This is not something that's discussed in the mainstream news. This is not something that you can find information online on any credible source. No one has...
That's not really true. One of the witnesses at the citizens' hearing... Dr. Thomas Vallone, we listened to him do a presentation on zero-point energy. Zero-point energy information's all over the place out there. This guy just hasn't run into it. It's true we don't hear about it in the mainstream, but I feel that this audience listening here certainly has heard of zero-point and knows that there's physicists out there doing it.
It seems to me that if there was an experiment that tapped into such an unbelievably unlimited supply of energy like that, it would be impossible to keep this under wraps, that you would be able to keep the conversation under wraps.
No, it's not true. And in fact, if you go to the website, seriousdisclosure.com, mm-hmm. there's a portal there to the energy research, and there are thousands of documents and pages of stuff, things that were reported in the media, and then they got confiscated and shut down. But you're asking this question as if academia and the media are operating freely. Not mm-hmm. under these suppressive behaviors, and I.
Well, I'm asking the question actually because just the nature of human curiosity and incredibly brilliant, intelligent men that are right. out there that study energy. I would think that someone would look into this and examine it.
Okay, well, there is, and in fact, one of the people that we were funding for a while before he got threatened by a former CIA director who went down to his SCIF, his Secure Communication Intelligence Facility. Was an understudy of William S. Bender at the University of Washington.
And he got threatened in what they said.
In 1974, I think it was 74, he formed a company, and he's a brilliant, one of the most brilliant people I've ever met, and he had developed these trans-dimensional systems using electromagnetic energy. And some guys came in with a national security order, told him that they were confiscating his equipment, his device, his notes, they were all going into the vault.
Right.
And this man, who I knew very well, who stayed at my home and still works for under contract with CIA and various groups, he said that basically the intelligence community owns his soul and that they can only do only so much to provide information and bring this out. And, you know, people who think that doesn't happen are living in a very naive world.
This is 40 years ago, though, you're talking about.
And it would happen.
70
what? No, that was 40 years ago when the thing he started. Then after I developed a relationship with him, he checked with his intelligence, what they call the shepherds, his handlers in the intelligence community. They said, yes, you can work with Dr. Greer, not on the propulsion stuff that flies around like a UFO, but just on the energy generation part of this. And so we provided a grant to him through my project, the Orion Project.
Which so the government limits his ability to do research on specific topics?
Well, he actually is on the payroll of the government now because he was basically told it's this or you have no career at all. And if he had disclosed what he had invented in 1974 under the national security order he was hit with, he would have been imprisoned. So, and these exist. You can look it up. It's Section 180, 181 of the Patent Law and the National Security Act. These national security orders happen all the time. So, but who's authorized? You think President Obama or the Senate Intelligence Committee knows that these goons are out there doing this stuff? No. And so here's this brilliant guy. But, I mean, he's not like he's Rambo.
Uh-huh.
I mean, he's an engineer and a physicist. So he develops this stuff. A bunch of guys come in who are badass folks, okay? And he's terrified. And so then all these years later, it circles back around. We get hold of him. And we say, look, okay, here's, you know, some funds. Do this for us on a, you know, generation 1.0 version of this, something, and check with your intelligence folks. And they cleared him. About the time he was beginning to put this thing together, a former CIA director with a bunch of goons came down in 2010, this is 2 years, 3 years ago, threatened him, threatened his family. And so...
What do they say to him? Like how
they say, you are not going to do this any further, and made it very clear. One of the guys at the Naval Research Labs I've worked with for years who has some of this information, he was told, we will kill you, your wife, your children, and your grandchildren if you step out of line on this. So I don't think that, you know, in terms of dealing with this, that you're going to be able to do it under any kind of where someone's trying to do it quietly, secretively. Mm-hmm. It's going to have to be in plain sight.
So what you're saying is that several people have tried to do this in the past.
Hundreds.
Every time they do it, they're threatened and stopped from doing it. Right. What specialized pieces of equipment would be necessary to produce this zero-point energy field thing?
Well, first of all, you know, your computer and lights here are running on 110 or 220, all right, voltage. The voltages involved in these transdimensional physics is in the thousands to millions of volts, but at very low current. And so you have to have special analyzers and generators for that. So, I mean, there is a science to this, and we understand it very, very well, actually. But building up that lab, I mean, we looked into the equipment, just as like $500,000 just to do that. And so what you have to do is...
That seems like nothing. If you're talking about $500,000 that can produce something...
No, that's just the equipment. No. There's no building, no personnel, no staff, no nothing. Just, you know, the machine.
Mm-hmm.
So we estimate, we have a budget for about a two-year program, around $6 million, to put a lab together, put these really brilliant people in it, get the right equipment, and build up these experiments and do real science. But the problem is you have people off on their own doing this that stumble across this phenomenon and they get shut down or threatened or bought out. Then, you know, you have the folks who will be, instead of threatened, they'll just be offered money. You know, so a lot of people, Dr. Bearden tells the story of a man that had one of these generators and he was testing it. It was a legitimate over unity system. And then the guy disappeared. And the next time he saw the guy, he had a Ferrari and an Armani suit. And the guy never had a pot to pee in, as it were. And you know, what we found with this is that a lot of times folks will just say, look, you know, we're going to buy this. A lot of people don't believe that happens, and they think that's a conspiracy theory. It isn't a conspiracy theory. And this is why the Federation of American Scientists, when they said, look, there are 5,135 or something like that patents that have been seized, most people don't know that those national security orders can happen outside of the patent process. So even if you're not going the patent route, they can go in there and just seize the damn thing. And what are you going to do?
They just seize it based on the idea that it's somehow or another a threat.
Well, it's kind of like the flag and the Bible. That you wrap yourself in these things to do all kinds of outrageous behaviors.
Yes.
But, I mean, you can say it's national security, but as this one document from the Federation of American Scientists says, how could a solar voltaic system be a threat to the national security? Mm-hmm. It would be a threat to the special interests that are calling the shots. So the question becomes, who's really calling the shots on these sort of decisions? Is it in the interest of we the people? No. It's in the interest of... folks who want to protect their cartels.
What is your take on guys who have come clean before, guys like Dr. Robert Lazar? Is that guy full of shit? He's the guy from Area 51 that came back and said that he was back engineering some alien craft, and very compelling to listen to, very interesting guy. But from what I understand, Dr. Stanton Friedman questioned him and, in fact, called him a fraud and said that some of his educational background was kind of made up.
Right. But, and here's the problem with any case where you hang it on one person like that is very risky. And that's why I've tried to resist that. And when we started putting together the people who knew about the nuclear facilities with their UFOs coming over, I didn't want one or two. I wanted half a dozen or a dozen. That's what we have. The more spectacular the case is, if it hangs on one person, And the other question is, where's the corroboration? So I think that's why we try to focus on that. Now, I will say that the areas out in the Nellis Range, and nobody, by the way, calls it Area 51, but let's just say that.
Groom Lake?
Pahoot Mesa, S-4, S-3, S-12. And actually, this National Reconnaissance Office document from the 1990s lists those facilities there properly, you know.
Well, that's after
the blackjack
control. They had to apply for additional land. Before that, they denied it entirely.
Right, right.
They had to apply for additional land because people were getting so close that they could film footage of some of these crafts that they were experimenting on. And that's not bullshit. If you've ever seen,
no one knows
what those things were, but the way they were moving was extraordinary. They moved unlike any craft that we know. I would assume that if you look at what we're doing today in all different parts of the world with drones, especially these drones that have Hellfire missiles that, you know, can be fairly accurate when you're considering that they're being operated by someone halfway across the world.
Right.
That this probably has something to do with what they were working on back then when they're making these things fly around and do all these crazy turns and twists in the sky.
No, because the drones that are being reported are conventional propulsion systems, either jets or what we're talking about are things that are moving in a way that is outside the envelope of normal aerodynamic behavior. In other words, you cannot take something with a normal propeller or jet engine and accelerate it at 20,000 miles per hour, make a right-hand turn. And we have photos and images of these things doing this. So when you're doing that, that's going to, you know, your brains are going to come out of your nose if you're a pilot. And even a conventional object is going to be blown to smithereens by the inertial forces of that kind of turn and deceleration.
I think we're going to be talking about two different things, though.
I'm talking about things that have been seen.
But you're talking about things that have been seen in space.
No, I'm talking about things that
at Area 51.
At Area 51 and also all over the world that have been documented moving in this way. Those are moving, and I'm quoting actually General De Brouwer of the Belgian Air Force chief, who said this is outside the envelope of any conventional aerodynamic system.
I'm not questioning that, but what I am saying is that the things that I've seen as far as videos from Area 51 with these unidentified objects, whatever they were, moving across the sky, they weren't moving that fast. They were moving conventional speed.
Oh, well, that's conventional. So that could be, but I'm talking about the things that I know that have been imaged out there, including a daytime object. We have a great video.
What is this video that you're showing us, Brian? What was that?
This is
lower your mic, man.
49 quadcopters in an outdoor formation flight. Let me see that. It's a pretty badass video.
This is these are conventional. You could actually buy these, right? Aren't these?
I'm not sure.
Are they DARPA? Is this DARPA shit?
No, this is Ars Electronica.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Well, actually, you can buy a little miniature.
Pull it down
now,
so we can see.
Yeah.
If you've never seen this, what they can do now is really extraordinary. I mean, this is all these drones moving. Or what do you call them? What are
they? They're just like little toys almost.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah. But I'm sure a lot of people saw this in the sky and was like, oh my God, what the fuck's that? And called it, you know, UFOs.
Yeah, look how they move. I mean, this is really amazing stuff. They move in a geometric pattern in the sky that mimics galaxies.
All right. That's cool.
So we know that there's some things that, I mean, these are obviously terrestrial crafts. This is something, look what they're doing. I mean, that's amazing. This is not UFOs. This is identified flying objects.
I mean, not everything that people see that they don't know what it is a UFO. I mean, it's unidentified to them, and it may be flying. But, you know, I'm talking about things that are really quite amazing, like this one photograph we have of this triangle that's going like this, and it makes a right-hand turn and goes, and it's going enormous.
A photograph or a video?
Photo.
Can we see this somewhere?
I don't know it's going to be in the film, but
it's going to be in the film, but it's available online, isn't it? I mean, it must be.
I don't know.
How long has this been around for?
I'll have to look it up. I don't have the cut of the film in here, but there are a number of these.
But this is a very compelling piece of evidence.
Yes, it's amazing.
Why wouldn't you put that online immediately and say, hey, you got to look at this. This is a compelling piece of evidence.
I think it is online somewhere, but I mean, I just can't tell you where. You know, we have thousands of pages on our website. If you go to seriousdisclosure.com, you can click through and there's a whole photo gallery and all kinds of stuff.
Oh, really? Okay, go
but I don't know if this particular one is in that photo gallery. But for example, you look at the Vancouver Island photograph of a few years ago. I think it was in the 80s. It's daytime, disc with a dome. Mm-hmm. It is not photoshopped. It was studied at NASA Ames. It's probably the clearest photograph ever taken, broad daylight.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what is that?
Well, you know, it's just like these ones from Belgium where you have these photographs of these big triangular objects, and there are photo and video of those matching up with radar cases and jet pilots chasing them. I'm talking about those kind of things. There's actually more than people can imagine that's out there.
Okay, so there's enough of these things where if you look at, I believe Michio Kaku said 5% of all UFO sightings are completely unexplainable, defying the laws of physics, and may possibly be, in his opinion, something that we don't understand. Right. Could be possibly.
Yeah, that's the one I'm talking about. The other stuff, yeah.
What do you think they're doing here?
That's a $64 trillion question. Yeah. I think there are a number of things. Number one, I don't think it's new at all. I don't think there's a new phenomenon. There's enough material out there from ancient times that would indicate that these objects have been around since recorded history. I mentioned this earlier in the show. But secondly, I think this stage of our evolution, these civilizations are rather concerned about our potential to destroy this planet and ourselves, but also the fact we're going into space. We have not become peaceful. And in the classified projects, we have things way beyond the International Space Station. So that we could become an existential threat to other planets, potentially. So I think that there is a concern about that. And I think that, you know, there are all these movies, you know, Battle Los Angeles and Independence Day and blah, blah, blah.
Or Avatar, like the other way.
You know, it's, yeah, and it's such, to me, it's like, okay, yeah. It's like when I went to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, where they had the blue room that Barry Goldwater tried, Senator Goldwater tried to get in, and you know the
Hangar
story.
Hangar 18, yeah.
Yeah, well, it wasn't that. But the thing is that...
That's on Hangar 18, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base?
Yeah, but it's...
This is a different thing at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base?
Right, it was called the blue room.
Is that where supposedly the Roswell wreckage was
Yeah, the Air Material Command, and then when I was there...
By the way, very compelling piece of evidence that there might have been something serious going on other than a weather balloon, the fact that two separate planes were used to send this wreckage because in case one of them went down.
Right.
It was so historically significant. I have that that newspaper, the Roswell Daily Record, I have that page on my wall in my house, and I look at it all the time. It's a fascinating... I mean, it's essentially... A press release by the military saying we've recovered a crashed disc
before they pulled it back. Yeah.
It's amazing because that's a big statement. You know, I mean, you look at all the things that could have been they could have been wrong about, like it could have been something else. But the fact that they came out and said it's a crashed disc that had never been done before that really was one of the right. first.
I think some heads rolled over that press release, but. Because they had to pull it back.
Well, and, then they did that ridiculous dog and pony show where they brought out this shitty-looking aluminum
foil.
Yeah,
it kind of looks like a Mylar thing.
It's hilarious. Yeah. That's quite hilarious. And the government, if you just look at the history of deception that the government has in dealing with the American public from the get-go, and whether it's with the Gulf of Tonkin incident or whether it's what happened with the Contras and the Sandinistas using, you know, taxpayer dollars and black ops from selling cocaine in the ghettos of Los Angeles to fund rebel armies. If you just look, you've got to know they're not telling the truth. Why would they tell the truth? If it was just a weather balloon, would they really put on this fucking dog and pony show where they'd have a general sit there or was a colonel, whoever it was, on his knees pointing out all the rest. Look at this. It's just wreckage.
Right. Well, that's what Colonel Corso said. Yeah. That, you know, there's no question that this was something very legitimate. And in fact, you know, when Barry Goldwater, Senator Goldwater, who had McCain's seat before John McCain took it in Arizona, I was at his home some years ago and he had left the Senate and he told me, he said, look, he says, it was a goddamn mistake then. It's a goddamn mistake now that this was ever kept secret. But he was an Air Force Reserve general, and he told me, Senator Goldwater said, look, I asked Curtis LeMay, General LeMay, to get me into the Blue Room at Wright-Patterson because I wanted to see this stuff because he had heard reports from other pilots about UFO encounters. And Senator Goldwater told me that Curtis LeMay said, look, Barry, I can't even get into that area anymore. And if you ever ask me about this again, I will personally see that you are court-martialed out of the Air Force Reserves. This to a sitting senator and a guy who had run for president, of course, in 1964.
I wish I knew whether that actually happened.
Yeah, no, that's amazing.
I love those stories.
Well, I was sitting there with the senator, and I have a guy who was there with me. And, you know, when I asked him, was Curtis LeMay serious? He said, yeah,
like a heart attack. He says, I never brought it up again. And so the question becomes, you know, when you have someone like Curtis LeMay, who admits, if you Google who he was, who admits to the fact that at a certain point, even he was being kind of sidelined in terms of access of this information, and then threatens and says something like that to a sitting powerful U.S. senator, that they were good friends. I mean, they were buddies. You know, there's something going on here. And I've heard too many accounts like that from these sorts of people. And I think it's a time for people to understand that, you know, ruthless people are out there and they do this sort of stuff. So, you know, when what happened for the last 60 years continues to go on and on and on, the people who try to move into this, who are politicians, end up hitting the same buzzsaw that Senator Goldwater did.
These incredibly powerful, technologically advanced beings that come here from another planet and are concerned with the fact that we've developed the power to blow ourselves up, but yet lack the understanding, the intellect, or the spiritual capacity to recognize what the dangers and the repercussions of those actions would be. What are they? Are they? Is anybody communicating with them? Does anybody have a message from them? Is there anything that they say will be done if we keep fucking around? I mean, is there any doctrine that they're trying to push on us?
Oh, I don't know if there's any doctrine. I think they're waiting for us to reach, you know. Mentioned this physicist mentioned, you know, a level one civilization, right, or a level two, where we begin to behave in a halfway civilized way so that we could be quite open in our contact. But I think, you know, I think everyone always says, well, why don't they just land on the White House lawn or something? I said, mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Who's White House?
Right.
Humans.
Us, because we rule.
Yeah, right.
This is America.
Right,
fuck
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but maybe the White House in Bogota, Colombia. I think the question turns the whole issue upside down. Mm-hmm. What do we have to do as a people and a civilization to be able to go into space and have open contact with these civilizations quite in a overt way as opposed to episodic way? Mm-hmm. And I think that requires us to begin to behave peacefully. It certainly requires that we not begin to weaponize space and that we stop doing things that are incredibly self-destructive. But, the idea that they're going to land here and enforce – it's like us going to Afghanistan and think we're going to impose Jeffersonian democracy on a medieval feudal society. Really? That never has worked. So I think these civilizations are smart enough to know that that isn't the way this is going to happen. The humans – but the problem is that I kind of think we're running out of time to get some things right, things that should have been fixed 100 years ago, like – living together peacefully, bringing out these technologies so we don't destroy the biosphere, eliminating poverty in the world. You know, 48% of the public doesn't have a pot to pee in. Literally, they don't have indoor plumbing on this planet. 48% of the 7 billion people. A lot of people don't know that. So, you know, I think that until we begin to fix some of these larger problems, and the good news about all this is that it's fixable, and the means, the technologies to do that are already in existence. So if they're already in existence and this science has been studied and suppressed and studied and suppressed for decades, it means that we as a people have to come together and say, all right, we're going to do this. And I think this is why the sort of, I hate to use the word activist, but or advocacy, part of what we're doing is that people are always expecting someone else to do this, you know. And I think people have to say, no, each of us have to be responsible for the planet and for our future and kind of creating a good future. You can't look to Big Brother to do it. And I don't think you should look to the ETs to do it. And not that they're not going to help us if we at some point we reach a point of being functional as opposed to dysfunctional. But I think the prime movers have to be the people, we the people. And you know, my mom's family were some of the original people in the American Revolution. Way back, terrible to say, we were some of the first prisoner of war with the British. But I think about the fact that, you know, here you had this ragtag bunch of people in the American Revolution taking on the most powerful navy, most powerful empire in the world at the time, the British Empire.
I think people have to see that within the human spirit, we have the means to do this. And a lot of people give too much power to where I don't think it should be provided to these covert groups and these sort of cartels. I think, again, I'm getting back to this idea of empowerment where we have exactly the power we're willing to manifest and no more. But if we're going to sit on our hands and expect someone else to do it, we're in trouble. And there's been too much of that. And there needs to be, I guess, some moral courage here. And I, you know, this is what's sticking me about, you know, the politics of the media and then, you know, all these scandals, like you were talking about with Petraeus and, you know, during the Clinton era, the Monica Lewinsky thing, I call it the blowjob heard around the world. That it's just so much nonsense.
Yeah.
Whereas these big issues are the moral issues, mm-hmm. as I see it. You know.
Well, I think if you look at us as a being, as an entity, and our progress in this on this planet, it's so staggering over such a short period of time that I think our minds, our ability to pass down information, all of these things lag behind. We're essentially waking up in the middle of history. I mean, as a race of beings, right. humans, we're waking up in the middle of a massive amount of momentum. As you're born, you are born into a race that is moving in an incredibly powerful direction that it's very hard to stop. And it's also the same animal that just 20,000, 30,000, go back as far as you want, where we were essentially tribal monkey people.
Right.
I mean, that's all of those instincts.
Listen up, everybody. One of the major problems we have today is if you go to BBC News, The Guardian, New York Times, Washington Post, Spiegel International, Wall Street Journal, you're seeing a bunch of made-up stories, trapdoor stories. A small percentage of it is true, 10%. The other 90% is made-up junk. It's propaganda. It's designed to program your mind within the matrix to believe something. If you look at any of these, you're going to see war, you're going to see rape, you're going to see murder right on the front page. And the next day you're going to see war, rape, and murder. And the next day you're going to see war, rape, and murder. And the next day you're going to see war, rape, and murder. Why are you wasting your time with this? Why? Why aren't you going out there making initiatives in your local area to change Earth and to bring in new Earth? Why are you searching, searching, searching on the blogs until you find something that you resonate with that's going to lift up your soul instead of going inside and lifting up your soul for yourself? And then when your soul is lifted, go out into the world and bring something new and change this mess that we're functioning from. Why sit on your hands, watch the old media that's all lies, watch the world go by, look up into the sky and cry because you don't understand why ET doesn't come here and help us? We have to help ourselves. And I'm really worried. I'm really worried.
Things that allowed us to get to 2013 are all encoded in our genome. All of those instincts, all of those reward systems are all encoded. And all of those reward systems, whether you look back to Napoleon or Genghis Khan, or look at any war figure, any dominator throughout human history, the people in power have always tried to keep in power and suppress others.
Well, they do.
And they do. But I think also, if you look at the power of technology to overwhelm everything, including the head spook of the CIA, I mean, he was essentially overwhelmed by email. That's what took him over. You know, I mean, it was the FBI looking into things, but essentially it was all done through electronic means. It was all done through – he was revealed – by the very powers that the CIA uses in the first place. They're spies.
And the National Security Agency even better.
On. The top spy was spied on. Mm-hmm. It's, in my opinion, when I look at human history and I look at where – just try to extrapolate. When I try to extrapolate where we're going, it seems to me that it's all symbiotically connected to technology. And that seems unavoidable. That's why I have such a hard time with the idea of someone creating some zero-point energy thing that's not that people aren't looking into. Enough people know about what Tesla was working on. Enough people are fascinated by the ideas of wormholes. And I just would think that more people would be involved in this, and that the government, with all its shady, nefarious arms, wouldn't be able to put out all of those fires.
But a lot of it's self-censoring. For example, I'll give you a really good example. There was an academic guy that I was talking to recently, and he was wanting to push into this issue. And basically, he was told, no, you're not going to do it at this university because this is violating the second law of thermodynamics and blah, blah, blah. You know, in a rational world, which is what you're talking about, I would agree with you. But we don't live in a rational world. We live in a world where there are a lot of emotions and power hierarchies and all kinds of dysfunctions. And so you have to factor that into the equation. And I don't think you can underestimate the reach of the national security state, not just here but around the world, to put out these fires, no matter how many times they try to surface, unless it's done in a very large way. And I didn't believe that, and I've learned the hard way trying to do it in a smaller fashion. From this, like the story I told you about this scientist who works in a skiff down near the Huntsville Space Flight Center, Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville. And I think what we are going to have to do is organize an effort that is very much outside of government and mainstream corporations and even academia. Because academia, if you've never been in it, is so political. I mean, you touch these sort of issues and it's the end of your career. I'll give you a great story in terms of other institutions. You know, the National Science Foundation is a very big player in global warming studies and all this kind of stuff. And the deputy director of that, and Dr. Bob Carril, and I had a long meeting with another person who was one of the five directors of NASA back some years ago. And he was very interested in exactly what you're talking about, these sciences and studies. And I said, look, we need some people at the National Science Foundation to really take this on as an area of research, development, funding, et cetera. He says, it'd be the end of my career if I did this. I said, well, you know, here is the future of the Earth or your career. What are you going to choose? Let's choose the Earth and our future. But the truth is everyone puts their pants on one leg at a time. And a lot of folks are not going to jeopardize their careers and their income. A very famous astronomer who worked with Carl Sagan was at our meetings in 1997 that we did for Congress. And after he did that with us, he was told if he ever wanted to be published again, write again, or have a career in astronomy, he'd have to leave this issue alone. So he was directly threatened, and he begged me to keep going forward, but that he couldn't be part of it. And so I think that, you know, most people don't realize that this happens every day. And it's kind of a miracle that this many military and corporate and intelligence people came together this far. But I won't even begin to tell you what we've gone through trying to get this far. It's been very difficult. And so for every person you hear about and that you see in this film series or in the Disclosure Project, there are 100
that wouldn't
that have given me the information and even documents and intelligence, but they don't want to come out and be identified. So there's a lot of fear of either reprisals, but also just the ridicule factor. Mm-hmm. You know, I have a document from 1953 from the CIA that talked about engaging Disney Studios to make cartoonish movies about this issue so that it would be the butt of jokes. Mm-hmm. And this document talks about the psychological warfare value of the subject. So, you know, people are sort of like, you know, in middle school where you're worried about what are people going to think about me if I say I think this is real? Are you going to lose credibility if you're a doctor or a physicist or an engineer or a politician?
Wasn't that all part of Project Blue Book?
This predated this actually predated that when they were first coming together with how do we manage this because it's hidden in plain sight. People are going to see these objects. There's no way to really sanitize it. You know, people think you can really get rid of this. Well, you can if there's a certain number of people seeing this all the time who are highly credible. So, but if you created a milieu, an environment where it's ridiculous and you're considered a kook or this or that, if you're identified with it, or you'll be, you know, Governor Moonbeam or Senator Space Cadet or something. And this is one of the real problems is that the subject has been so ridiculed and there's so much ridiculous stuff out there on the subject that's provably nonsensical. that credible people really have to swallow hard. I have to tell you, the scientists that are at this major Ivy League university doing the work on this little body, this little humanoid type body, you know, it's a big, big thing for them to be working on this. And it's even a bigger thing that they're going to go on the record about their findings.
So when are they going to do this?
In the next, well, you'll see on April 22nd, come to the premiere.
I'll come to the premiere, but on April 22nd, what if no one has made some sort of a public statement? No Ivy League scientists?
No,
they're going to. So
you're
promising between now and April 22nd, there'll be some sort of a reveal.
We'll have some press releases.
Major institution, scientists of credible history will step forward and say, hey, this is something extraordinary.
Well, we don't know what they're going to say. They're still doing the run on the genome.
Well, it's extraordinary if it's real. If
let me put that to rest right now.
You touched it.
Yeah. I've touched it. We have the CAT scans. We have the reports from these top scientists. The only thing left that we're doing is running the genome, which is the whole genome.
So the scientists have said that it's absolutely of biological origin. That
yes.
It's not like my werewolf.
No.
It's not a
no,
rubber.
No, this we know. This we absolutely know. And put that to rest.
Has this damaged your credibility in life? I mean, have you suffered because of this in any way, shape, or form?
Sure.
Of course. In what way?
Every way.
Yeah?
Yeah. It's been the hardest thing. You know, I tell people the worst days in the ER where, you know, I held a 3-year-old that died in my arms. This has been hard. So, you know.
It's harder than the death of a little baby, really?
Yeah. With the stuff we've had to deal with.
Like in what way?
Horrible stuff. I don't really want to go into it. I mean, we probably don't have time, but every nasty thing that can be done has been done or attempted to be done to many of us, and particularly to us, my family, and not my family so much as you know, targeting me with nastiness of just unbelievable
ridicule.
And this
is
no
beyond
that.
Threats.
And, yeah.
People threaten you to what? Stop talking about UFOs?
You know, problems that we've had with a lot of security problems. I mean, there's an FBI file open on this because of the death threats and this stuff we've had.
Really? And
yes.
So you think these death threats are from these people that you're exposing that are in the cabal of this international...
Well, who knows where they're coming from? You could just say it was some nut job, like the people who shot up the Sikh temple, where
right.
our director's family, as you know.
Yes.
His father was... murdered horribly at this thing, and but you know, I'm just saying that it's a lot easier being an emergency doctor than dealing with this issue when you know it's real and you're dealing with this level of intelligence in the CIA.
Has this affected your career?
Yeah, I've left medicine, not because I had to. No, I mean, but because I had to choose. How do I put this? You only have 24 hours in a day, and you know, at a certain point, I had to decide. I'm either going to continue as a physician or I'm going to go full steam on this. Now, of course, it was a big sacrifice for my family. I was giving up hundreds of thousands of dollars a year as a doctor to do this for nothing. All right. So it's been difficult. So that's what I'm saying. It's been difficult in every way. But that, you know, that's not important. I'm not important.
But it isn't. No, but stop. It is important. And it's a tremendous sacrifice, especially because it's something that you really truly believe in. How do you support yourself now?
Well, I have enough resourcefulness. Before I left medicine, I bought my home, and I'd saved enough and invested enough that I'm okay. And then I have a little bit of income from some of the books and things, but I mean, it's very modest compared to, you know, what I would have been making. I'd probably in the aggregate have given up around somewhere in the neighborhood of $5 to $6 million in income doing this, which I actually don't regret at all. Because I don't care about the money.
I hate when people say that.
Hmm?
I hate when people say that.
No, I really don't. I mean, this is why, you know, now this, you'll probably strain credulity here, but a former head of Army Intelligence approached me in 1992 and offered me the kind of control over a $2 million fund if I would shut up and close down the Disclosure Project in Sea City.
A control over a $2 billion fund?
With a B.
To do
and
what? What did he want you to do?
He just basically wanted I could do anything with it so long as I would shut
You could just go big pimping, giant yacht, Ferrari.
Who knows?
No more Dr. Greer.
And then, you know what I said? No, I'm not going to do that because I really believe that this issue needs to be dealt with properly. The guy went to my wife and tried to convince her to convince me. And this, you know, this is the kind of nonsense.
Did he want you to work for him, or he just wanted you to shut up?
He wanted me to merge what we were doing with some operation he had, which would have basically subsumed it and co-opted it. And I said no. And then he made another run, and I said no. And then about a month after that, all over the internet, it came out that I wasn't even a doctor. Here I am in this emergency department, and it's a bunch of goons put out there that I'm not even an actual MD. And I'm there, you know, up to my eyeballs in blood and guts in the ER, and this thing breaks. So, you know, they do all kinds of disinformation and psychological warfare stuff on people. But I don't really mind that that's happened. What I'm more concerned about is the people who have the knowledge and responsibility don't do the right thing, because there's no way that I can do this by myself. And what I was really gratified to see, and I'm still gratified to see, is, you know, are all these people, the military men and women and others who come forward very courageously, academics like the ones doing the work on this potential little humanoid creature, which is a real creature, what it is, we don't know. But it's a really courageous thing for these people to be doing that. The people who led the charge in France to release all those documents, I know the backstory to that the public doesn't know, and it was very controversial. So, I mean, this is the kind of courage we need to get the truth out and to go forward as a civilization. And so, you know, you can't buy it. You got to have it. You got to manifest it from inside.
Are you getting income from this?
No.
You don't get any income from this.
No, this is, you know, and you know what's beautiful about Sirius, the movie, is that it was all crowdfunded. No one on my team has taken any funds from it. It's all gone into the production of the movie.
You don't even take a salary?
No, oh no, no. It's all gone into the film.
But you list expenses, like don't you list like several hundred, like $270,000 or something in expenses that you charge to create this this film?
Oh, yeah, but that's the production company, you know, because I'm not a filmmaker.
Right.
And don't ask me to turn on camera.
So the money goes to this production company.
Yes, and then, of course, we're going to, you know, we have to organize the premiere. And, of course, being crowdfunded, you have to fulfill all the incentives for the crowdfunding. I don't know if you know how crowdfunding works.
Yeah, I do.
But I want to thank everyone who's listening, by the way.
Did you do Kickstarter or something along those lines?
Yeah, we did Kickstarter and then our own private program. And, you know, we have like 4,000 people who have contributed funds to this, which is really a huge number of folks. And by the way, all of you folks who've done that, can I say this? The premiere is going to be here in Los Angeles on Earth Day, April 22nd, at the LA Live, the Regal LA Live Cinemas downtown, the Premiere Theater. And so that's April 22nd. If you want to come, you can kind of sign up and get tickets at seriousdisclosure.com.
I'm writing that in my calendar right now. I'm going to try to make that. That sounds really fascinating.
Hey, tweet it for us, and you're invited to come. Come as my guest.
Please, I'll tweet the shit out of it.
I'd love to have you as my guest if you want.
I would love to go.
We're going to have a red carpet, and we're going to invite some other you know, people here in Hollywood and in the business. And it's going to be an exciting event. I mean, the theater only holds 809 people, of which about half of those seats are already spoken for. But you know, those of you who want to come, you know, just hop online and, you know, the system is set up so you can do it all digitally. You know it's not going to be tickets at the door, though.
Okay. What is this thing that you're doing where you lead people out into the desert and you have them make contact with something, ethereal crafts and beings, and what is that?
Well, that's the whole CE5 concept I was talking about, Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind, that we're using these different protocols. And by the way, there's a smartphone and an iPhone app for this that you can get at seriousdisclosure.com. So it has all the it'll actually turn your phone into a magnetometer. It has the tones that were recorded in this crop circle of this weird energy that came into the crop circle.
I can get this on my phone right now?
Yes, you can download it.
What is it called?
It's called the Contact app. You can go to seriousdisclosure.com and there's an icon there and you can link and it goes to the iTunes store or the Android store.
Okay, and tell me what happens when you take these. You'll take anyone out there? Do they have to go through a screening process?
Like, yeah, there's an app. I mean, it's a course. We do about a week training of people and remote viewing and the protocols of contact and sort of the whole concept of it, but also how to look at the night sky. You go out with satellite charts. We have fourth generation night scopes. We have really good cameras. And, you know, in fact, we're going to be doing one in Colorado in June in the high desert. I have some land up there.
What is the actual name of this app? Because there's a couple contact apps.
Well, yeah, again, you have to go to seriousdisclosure.com, and there's a link there for it. You know, the name of it will be on the site.
You don't know the name of your own app?
You know what? I have so many irons in the fire. I think it's called ET Contact App.
Oh, but, ET Contact App. Let me try that. Yeah. ET Contact App. So, and explain to me what happens here. You have a course, and in this course, what do these people do?
The idea is that we want to teach them.
Right? That's your signal.
Yeah, that is.
Okay.
So,
I just bought your app. Powerful. Okay, so explain to me. Where would someone sign up for something like this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we do these expeditions a few times a year. I used to, you know, there are only about 20 people who are allowed to come now.
20 at a time?
Because I can't handle more than that for a week out in the desert or out in the mountains. But and I just don't have time to do it more often than the 4 or 5 times a year that we do it.
So you essentially do it quarterly?
Mm-hmm.
You
the seasonally. But the schedule is up at seriousdisclosure.com. There's a place.
Where do you bring these people?
It just depends. I mean, like, the next one's going to be in the high desert of Colorado at about 8,000 feet. It's a remote area near the Great Sand Dunes that's had a lot of reports of UFOs and contact. In fact, the film director and his crew were out there last June, a few months ago, in 2012, when we had this disc fly over, and then a jet came in to intercept it, and just, and that's going to be in the film. It's really cool.
You have a video of that or a photo of that?
Both.
Really? So you have a video of this disc in the sky and then a jet approaching the disc and
a disc. Probably coming out of Colorado Springs because it was coming out of that direction. But, yeah, it's really pretty cool. And, of course, I think when the director saw this, he went, oh, wow.
And who put this video together? Who made it? Who filmed it?
The film crew for Sirius.
So you wow.
So,
I want to make sure that I'm real clear of this. You have thousands of these videos?
Well, there's one. If you go again to this website, you'll see that there's a section for where the contact expeditions and the CE5 expeditions. And a couple years ago, we were up on, there's a mountain north of here called Mount Shasta near the Oregon border in the Cascade Range. And it's a volcanic mountain. We've gone up there a number of years, and we've had these objects that have appeared. And one of them was actually in the field. We had our night vision camera running, and it lifted up and does this, and then does like this corkscrew and dematerialize in the sky. We had this on videotape, and it was during one of these expeditions, and it's a really amazing bit of video.
Is ball lightning a real phenomenon?
Sure. But this is clear skies, no weather.
But coming up
from the ground.
But doesn't ball lightning have something to do with there's certain types of visual phenomena that have to do with tectonic plates and pressure and stress?
Piezoelectric.
Yeah, what is that?
Well, that's very different also. That'll be just sort of a discharge, like an electrical discharge.
You can see it.
And that's from the rocks, and usually it's when there's quartz. The pressure of it and the electromagnetic energy will build up and it'll burst out. But, you know, this is an object, and you can see it quite clearly. And it's right at the edge of the speed of light because it's kind of coming in and out of this dimension. It's a really great video. And there were like 30, 40 people who saw this happen. So we do this. I've been doing this for 22 years. And
what are you showing up there, Brian? What is that?
It was one of these objects that came over. I think that was at Mount Shasta. I'm not sure. It's my laser, and it's this object that came right over. And, you know, we also train people to always go out with satellite charts. When the satellite.
This is your footage
of
this thing flying in the sky?
Yep.
Whoa.
And
that's your laser?
That's my, I have a big, you know, it's one of these.
I got one of those.
Yeah, it'll go 100, 200 miles into space.
When you were filming this, are you trying to contact them? Like, what are you trying to
do? So we do the protocols where you do the remote viewing, set up the vector to show them where you are. We play these electronic tones in the space and then have electronic field detectors out there. So we'll have magnetic field detectors, various laser detectors, other electromagnetic spectrum. And those will begin to go off, and then we'll have an object fly over like this object here that was right near us. It comes right outside. So what people have to understand is that if you have an object that is coming in and out of dimensions, it's not going to necessarily look like a 747 or even a flying saucer. It's going to be in various energy forms. And this is the weird sort of effect. Most people don't understand that 99% of the time, an interstellar civilization doesn't have to be in linear space-time if they have that kind of physics. So what happens
when you go beyond the speed of light. All right, you're going to not have anything visible, but if you begin to have an energy discharge into an area of space, and it's very close to this dimension, it'll start to give off an energy field, our corona. And so one of the witnesses we have was at a nuclear hot base out in Oklahoma back years ago. I think it was in the 70s. And there was this object that was in the shape of a UFO, but it wasn't solid. And it flew over the what they call the hot, you know, where the jets were hot loaded with nuclear weapons. And the alarms went off. But he says this thing was not solid like this is, like your rock salt. It was, you could have walked right through it, but it was in the shape of a craft. But it was shifted so that the matter was all energy. And of course, matter is energy. So the physics behind this gets into some really arcane stuff, probably beyond the scope of the show. But it's what I, this is part of what we're teaching people when we take them out, is how do these objects appear? What might you see? And I was talking to an actor here in town who had one of these happen near his home. And it was very palpable, very real. But it wasn't.
Can you tell us who the actor was? We could tell you that they're full of shit.
No, there no. But he, you know, these are there are a lot of people who've had these sort of experiences. They don't want to talk about it,
right?
Because they're afraid of, you know, being ridiculed,
right?
And but you know, when it was described to me, I said, "Oh yeah, that's classic." They really? I said, "Yeah," because if it's not a Lockheed Martin, you know, anti-gravity, and it really is ET. The weirder it is, the more likely it is to be ET. And this gets into the whole question, what are you looking for? So we train people to know kind of what to look for versus, you know, if experimental aircraft, normal aircraft, you know, space objects and junk, satellites, and then the stuff that's the weird end of it.
So the weird end of it.
Yeah, the really cool stuff.
The really cool stuff. You take these people, you bring them out to the high desert, you tune them into whatever frequency through whatever methods of meditation or what have you, and these ships, are they just waiting for someone to, like, email them, send them a signal?
You know what I think? I think that they've actually been waiting a long time for people to do something besides just passively look at them.
Do they have to, but what I'm saying is, do they have to, like, load up the ship? Hey, we got some fucking people in the desert. Everybody, get on board. Let's go. How are you getting them to manifest?
I'm not getting them to.
How is this signal being recognized by them?
Because I'm quite convinced they have electronics that pick up on this, what we were talking about earlier, this conscious field of coherent thought. And this is, again, the most controversial end of what I'm doing. It, to me, it's the most interesting also. You know, before I was a doctor, I was a meditation teacher. I don't know if you know that. But,
no, I didn't know that. Yeah. What type of meditation?
Mantra and mm-hmm. Vedic. So okay. I was Vedanta and Vedic meditation. You know, I learned Sanskrit and learned to teach people meditation. So that was my first sort of career, if you can call it a career. It was an avocation as much as more than a vocation. But it was because of the result of this near-death experience. And I began to realize that really the thing that is most intriguing about all this is that free energy is like late 1800s to mid 1900s, anti-gravity mid 40s to mid 50s, the science of consciousness and the interface between mind and matter, mind and body, mind and thought and electromagnetic systems, that's the really cool stuff. And that's, you know, to me, most people know me for the Disclosure Project and these other things, but to me that's the most exciting part of this because that is the frontier. The final frontier is not space, it's consciousness.
So you take these people out, there's 20 of them, and you spend how many days out there?
It's usually 6 days and nights. And so we go out. But during the day, it's more a teaching module and teaching them remote viewing concepts, science of consciousness, other information they need to have. Then we, you know, go out at night, usually from around sunset to one or so in the morning, sometimes two. And we're in out in the stars making observation, doing the remote viewing practice. And then people go home and do it. There's now something like 1,100 or 1,200 teams all over the world doing this that have picked up on this idea. It's really a phenomenal thing. And people are having amazing sightings and experiences all over the world. There's a global CE5 initiative going on. And
It's really exciting.
You keep saying CE5. You mean Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind, which is visual?
No.
What is?
Okay, let me explain that. I'm sorry.
Because I know the movie, The Third Kind.
Yeah, the Steven Spielberg movie. Yeah.
That's how I know this. Most people are probably like me.
The fourth kind is when someone feels they've had contact and been on board. The fifth kind is a term that I launched the concept of in 1990, which is when humans, instead of passively having, so all those others, Close Encounters of the First, Second, Third, and Fourth Kind, are passive because you're sort of either seeing it or it's a landing thing or what have you. A Close Encounter of the Fifth Kind is when a human does something interactive. So it's like, you know, it's like the internet versus something passive, or where you're actually making contact and inviting these civilizations to appear and make contact for a diplomatic purpose, or where they interact. And Dr. Haynes at NASA, Ames, put together a great book based on my initial research on this called Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind, CE5, where he collected cases. We both collected cases, but he published this book some years ago about all these people who had done this. And some of them were quite incidental. For example, a craft is there and the person sees it, and instead of just gaping, they actually signal to it with, say, a light, and it signals back and comes over. The more interesting ones are the ones I discovered, which is what happened to me when I was 18, where you see a craft and you just think, move to the left, it moves to the left, move to the right, move to the right. And they're showing you that there's a link up between intent and thought and their electronics. That's the really cool stuff.
You ever read Carl Jung?
Mm-hmm, yes.
What do you think on Carl? I mean, he wrote a whole book on the physical manifestation of UFOs through the conscious thought.
Yeah, well, I mean, the world is as you are. And it depends on the level of consciousness of the person reading what he wrote. I think that a lot of people say, well, that means that everything is being manifested by your mind. Mm-hmm. Well, but in a sense, all of reality is one conscious thought, if you want to get back into the whole all this is that concept of the Vedic. But I think these are things when you have 30 or 40 people see it, and it's interactive, you know, right. It's a Close Encounter of the Fifth Kind. So it's not your imagination doing that, particularly when you get video. I don't even think
he was necessarily saying it's your imagination.
No, but he was, you know, a lot of people don't understand what he was saying. Mm-hmm. And I think that he was really talking about some deeper aspect of what is mind.
Right, what is mind?
What is mind?
What effect does consciousness have on physical matter?
Right, it's huge.
Yeah.
It's huge.
And in a sense, he could have almost been validating it without totally understanding the possibilities of contacting something, making something
appear. Right, I agree.
That you seem to be convinced of, and in fact teach people to do it. I think that if you've got something like that, how is this not like on 2020 or whatever those stupid news shows are? How are you not going out there?
Well,
would you be willing to do that with a film crew?
Oh, we did with CBS. Dan Rather had a show back years ago. What was it called? We went down to Mexico, Popo, and we did this, and a craft came up by the volcano, flew, and they were filming this with professional stuff, and they ended up completely debunking it. And even though the camera guy and the reporter who was there with me said, anyone who sees this will know this is real, and CBS sanitized it. And when I then said, look, you agreed in writing that any footage you get, you would share with us if we did this expedition, because we did it on our own expense, the person in charge there said, we're CBS and we're part of a corporation that has billions, and you don't. We'll fight you forever. You'll never get this footage.
Why would you need CBS, though? It seems like you'd be able to film something like that yourself in really high quality. You don't need their footage.
We do. I mean, we have a certain amount. Right. I don't operate cameras, but we've had volunteers. But we've never had professional crews with us. And, I mean, at some point, it'd be nice if we could do this in a professional way.
I have a crew. Right. I have a new show. It's coming out on the Sci-Fi Network.
Oh, really? What's it called?
It's called Question Everything.
And oh, good.
One of the things we're going to do. Yeah. And one of the things we're going to do is we're going to explore things like UFOs, Bigfoot. I'm going to go to the Pacific Northwest and look for Bigfoot. But I want to – I would love to go with you.
Let's go to the Atacama Desert and see if we can find
more of these things. Tell me where to go. Let's go. I would be more than happy to go and bring a professional crew and see if something like this can happen. What kind of success rate do you have in doing this?
Well, you know, we've never actually gone out where there hasn't been some kind of a sighting or event happen that had been seen by everyone.
Really?
Never.
So it's 100%?
Not every night, not all
the time. Right, but yes, but something
over a five or 6 day period. And are these people camping out there?
No. We don't stay. Well, I mean, I guess if someone wanted to, we usually stay in condos or houses or something in the area. We usually go to fairly, remote areas that are quiet. It's very hard to find locations where we're not going to be intruded upon. And usually when we do this, we do have people who intrude. And so we try to keep it, you know, so that the group can be coherent. Because the whole concept of this is coherent thought and coherent mind. And that's, you know, very difficult to do when you're being disrupted by a lot of folks.
Now, what if you pick 20 people to go? And how do you know that someone's not a loon? You take some crackpot out there.
Oh, well, there have been, you know. But, you know, usually the people, you know, we have an application process. And I you know, I'd say 99% of the time, they're just wonderful people. Right. And, you know, they're very sincerely interested in learning about this. And I think the science of consciousness component of the whole, what J. Allen Hynek called the high strangeness part of UFO encounters, becomes very compelling for people who've had contact and understand that when you go beyond the speed of light between star systems, you're dealing with something that's way beyond your cell phone and a Ford Explorer. And people who get that, who get out of the linear box and begin to look at that and then begin to experiment with, a lot of the people who come on these are people who have gotten the app or learned about it, and they try this at home, and they have an amazing sighting and encounter with a small group of people or a family, and then they want to come and try and do it more. So to me, that's the next phase of all this is, you know, disclosure, bring out the energy and technologies. But then it's about the public understanding that, well, why doesn't everyone just go out under the stars instead of sitting and looking at television and try some experiment with thought and mind and light and tone and
besides
all kinds of
floating
interesting
things in space. Mm-hmm. Haven't you encountered things that are in closer proximity to the ground?
Oh, yeah, and some very odd photographs of what you might call transdimensional images that look like almost like a hologram of a being that floated right outside of our circle at Joshua Tree National Park, not too far from here, back a few years ago.
You have photos of this thing?
Yep.
Where can someone see that?
It's on the website, seriousdisclosure.com. If you link to the CE5 part of it, there's a whole section of this strange, luminous thing. The photograph of that, it was a 3 or 4 second exposure. And what was seen right before this happened, which is really important for people to understand, was something about half the size of about the size of my fist or a little bigger. It was like a sphere that floated over the desert in November of 2009. And several people saw it. And then we heard what sounded like a group of people talking. But with our night scope, there's nothing there. And then, so a woman on my team took her camera and just had a 3 or 4 second exposure, took a photograph, and in that area where this had happened, there was this being that was...
And did you see this with your eyes, or is this just...
No, because this would have been in a flash, but it's in the digital.
Is it possible that it's just an artifact?
No, it's not an artifact, absolutely not.
Why is that not possible? I mean, flashes always produce artifacts. They produce
orbs. No, she did not use a flash.
Oh, okay.
It was visible. The flash was... So in other words, this was no flashbulb. No, we don't allow flash photography when we're out. You got to have good night scopes. You have to have good cameras. You can adjust the ISO and the aperture and all that.
Campfires?
No, we never have campfires. Huh? There's a complete darkness. The most you're going to see when we're out there is maybe an LED on a camera.
So whatever this thing was...
We know what it was.
You think it was...
Yeah, I'm very confident about what it was.
Have you ever been aboard a spaceship?
I've had some really amazing contact experiences that are classic. And they, you know, I had one when I was when I was 18 years old up on this mountain up in, it wasn't at all what you hear about in the literature, because it was more in this transdimensional element area. And that becomes the whole question, is what part of what people are reporting is real and what part is Memorex? And right, this is something we haven't talked about yet. But what is the capacity for the intelligence community to hoax
contact, and it's substantial.
Really?
Yeah.
You think a lot of people, they're hoaxing contact?
Yeah, for scaring the hell out of people.
Like in what way? How do they do that?
One of the things we learned about a number of years ago is actually not something I discovered. It was a man here who was looking into what are called military-related abductions that are made to look ET but aren't. And you get into this whole question of what are they able to stagecraft for its psychological warfare value. And I have a document that's actually going to be in the film, and it's from the Strategic Studies Institute talking about the staging of abductions and other scary things to create fear around the UFO issue.
So they create an artificial spacecraft to abduct people?
Well, they might use they may use what's called an ARV, an alien reproduction vehicle that's man-made. They may use robotic things that are called PLFs, programmed life forms, that are man-made but look very ET.
Programmed life forms?
Yeah, PLFs.
They have life forms that are like robots, essentially, that
right.
move around like people?
There are reports of that, and in fact...
reports of that.
And I think there's...
You believe that, though?
Oh, yeah. I think Stan Romanek, if you look at the photograph he had of this thing, I think he was on Larry King or some other shows, and this thing, Boo, that goes up and down. He's got a photo, and then there's a video that he hasn't released, but I've seen it, and other people on the team have seen it. And it's this very robotic-looking, it looks like a, quote, alien, but we know it isn't. The question is, why would they want to do something like that? I think if you can put enough information out there to scare people, why not scare
them? Well, it seems to me, though, that, look, the highest-level robotics experts in the world today are pretty open about their work. Because they're showing periodic improvements to the general public, like the DARPA robots, what they're doing in Japan. No one has come anywhere close to doing something along those lines. Not only that, they have an external power source.
Well, but you're assuming that the things that you know about are all that they're in existence. But it's like saying that because you haven't flown on one of Lockheed's or Northrop's anti-gravity devices, they don't have those either. I think that
they have those?
Yes.
They absolutely. Do, 100%.
Yes.
What, how does
and
it
Ben
work?
Rich all but said so, you know, who's the head of Lockheed Skunk Works. So these are a lot of the things that people will see out near the Nellis Range, or so-called Area 51, that are moving in these ways we were talking about earlier. Those are man-made. Those aren't ET. And if you go all the way back to the 40s in Germany during World War II and after, they were doing a lot of experiments with things that do electromagnetic lifter effect. And going back a little further, you look at T. Townsend Brown in late 1920s, and then also the Klosky-Frost experiment, where they actually were able to create this effect of levitation and movement. So, you know, again, there's a whole science here. And in the open aerospace literature in the late 40s and early 50s, they were saying the next big thing is gravity control and anti-gravity stuff and da-da-da-da-da. And then it all went black. And you can't find it. And one of the guys that I work with at the Naval Research Labs, which is the largest Department of Defense lab, told me that it was October of 54 when we really mastered gravity control. And all those projects went black. They just disappeared. But up until then, you can go back and find, and there were in the literature. Now, the fact that your average person at MIT doesn't know about this doesn't mean it didn't exist. And I think that there's a whole history of aerospace and technology that's hidden. Similarly, there's a whole history of robotics, genetics, biological studies, and what have you. And that had also been kept very classified.
You are either one really nutty dude, or you are a guy who has tapped into one of the craziest pieces of information that's being suppressed from the American public, and there's no room for a middle ground. You know,
I know that every word I'm telling you is true.
I believe you. You believe that every word out of your mouth is true.
Right.
I do believe you. But this whole thing is it so strains credibility.
It does. All of it does. Yeah. And you know what? I was told years ago that if you really told the whole truth about this, that it'll hide itself because no one can believe it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it is kind of through the looking glass and down the rabbit hole on this subject. And it's a real problem because how far do you go in terms of telling what you know and have discovered.
Well, it seems to me that you've tapped into like a way to show people.
Yeah, well, I mean, but who's looking? I mean, it's like this FAA guy, John Callahan, who said, I've got the radar tapes, I've got the pilot reports, but who's looking and who's asking?
Right.
Well, not 2020. You know, I mean, you asked about 2020. The guy who's executive producer of that came out to my house. I gave him 35 hours of digital stuff of all these top secret guys, all the documents, all this stuff. He said, this is the biggest story. It's either all a hoax or it's the biggest story in history. I said, yeah, well, I think it's the latter. And he says, I want to do this story. I said, I don't think they'll let you. And so we went back to corporate ABC. And a couple weeks later, he said, Dr. Greer, they won't let me do this story. I said, who are they, Ira? And he said, well, you know who they are. And I've had
producers. They're like, this crazy motherfucker. When I'm spending money.
This was the executive producer in charge of the show, both Primetime Live and 2020. And he's now with 60 Minutes. But I think that what...
I'd love to talk to him. What's his name?
Yeah, Ira Rosen.
I'd love to talk to him on the Question Everything show. That'd be fascinating.
Well, you know, I think that this is... the other big myth is that when you start dealing with the big media, that it's a free media. It's free to a point. I mean, it's no problem if you want to drill down on someone's sex scandal. But if you really want to deal with this issue, there's going to be a phone call. And you know, one of the documents that's up on our website, I wrote an article called Media Play. And in it is a document I got from the 1990s from the CIA that talks about how the CIA had embedded in all the major media people to change, alter, or stop stories. And this is an official document. So, you know, if the public listening out there think we really have a free market and a free media, you know, wake up. This is simply not the case. So I think that one of the challenges we've had is that the it's kind of an article of faith that if all this were true, wouldn't the media just really want to cover this? And I say, yeah, there are some really good people in the media who wanted to. They're not allowed to. And so then there's a good way, who controls the big media? But I'm not That's talking true. About your show.
Yeah, because, I mean, how many shows are out there dedicated to looking for UFOs? There seems like there's quite a bit. And those shows are owned by, you know, big media companies and networks that promote these shows. Yeah, you think it's just bullshit and what they're doing is paying lip service to it and not really looking and they're just covering the controversial aspects of it to get viewers?
Yes, I think a lot of it's shock and dribble and bread and circus. And I think that you then ask the question of, you know, years ago when I was on Larry King and afterwards I got this note from his producer that this is one of the most popular shows we've ever had. And so if it was just about ratings and just about whether there was anything legitimate there to cover, this would be in the news all the time. Mm. So there's something weird going on here because they'll cover all kinds of sensationalistic nonsense. But, you know, you have dozens of top secret witnesses, you have legitimate government documents, you have photographs, video, or you have teams like ours going out having these sort of experiences. That isn't covered. You have to ask the question why. And I think the wonderful thing about 2013 that didn't exist 5 or 10 years ago, Twitter, Facebook, video on demand. You know, you don't have to go to a big distributor. And actually, by the way, we're planning to distribute this film at the night of the premiere. Maybe we'll live stream it if we can figure out how to do it. Maybe you can help us.
I'll be happy to.
We need help with it, actually, because we're actually out of funds.
We'll contact Brad at Ustream.
Yeah.
We'll live stream the shit out of this bitch.
Yeah. And so what we want to do at the premiere is live stream it and then have the thing, and then it'll be VOD, video on demand, so that, you know, there's no chokeholds in the big media. And then, you know, you couldn't have done that 5 or 10 years ago with any kind of value. Now you can do high definition. You can do really good video on demand. And we're going to do this so that everyone can sign up to be an affiliate distributor. So that basically, if you want to distribute the show, you can distribute it. And the people who see it, you know, there'll be a small fee to see it, and then you'll have part of that. And you just build that out, because what we want to do is make this thing go viral. Uh-huh. So that we don't get into the chokeholds of the big media. Because, you know, I my experience with it is that I'm very, very skeptical of the big media doing anything with this until they have to. And then it becomes where there's too much noise out there. We have to give it a little bit of lip service and then we'll take it off again. So that's why, by the way, that's why we did this crowdfunding for this. It was that we really wanted the people
to have a stake in it and to move the film Sirius forward. Because if you went to a studio or a group of investors, you don't know what they're going to do with it if they control it. This way, the people own it.
So. Well, listen, man, this is a fascinating subject. Like I said, it's one of my personal interests and has been since I was a small child. To talk to you was a real treat. I really appreciate it.
I really appreciate
it. You put your neck out there, man. You say a lot of nutty shit, and it takes a lot of courage to do that, or you're crazy. I'm willing to believe you. I mean, I'm willing to be completely open to the point of I'll go out to the desert with you. I'll do whatever it is. I'm fascinated by all this stuff. And if what you're saying is true, it is, one of the most mind-blowing things our society has ever had access to, has ever been able to encounter. I mean,
right.
It's pretty crazy shit, man.
Well, welcome to the new millennium, because now it's time. Here we go.
I hope you're right. I mean, I hope this isn't just crazy talk. April 22nd is the day. It's in Los Angeles at LA Live, which is where?
It's the Regal LA Live.
The Regal LA Live. Mm-hmm. And how can people either find out about this or get to this, or if people want to go?
SiriusDisclosure.com, and you can go there and you can get the tickets and everything and sign up right there. Everything can be done online.
And is the film done?
It's going into final completion in the next 3 weeks or so, yeah.
Okay, so April 22nd is when it's all going down, and that is hopefully you will already have the information from this Ivy League Institute about this alien being by then, correct?
Or this humanoid being
humanoid,
that we don't know
whatever,
what it is.
Yeah, whatever it is. Whatever
we'll have, yeah, and we will. We already have a lot of it, but we're waiting for the final genetic sequencing.
Okay, and if people want to follow you on Twitter, it's Dr. Stephen Greer, Steven, not one of those weirdos that says Stephen, but it's with a PH.
Who does that?
Some weirdos.
No PH here.
Yeah, a lot of weirdos. Stephen PH. That's Stefan, right?
Stefan.
Okay. Dr. Stephen Greer, Steven Greer. And one more time, the website is?
SiriusDisclosure.com, SIRIUS Disclosure.com.
This has been a fascinating conversation. Thank you very much. It's been really interesting. And, I'm really looking forward to seeing where this goes.
We'll see you at the premiere.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Will you do this again? Will you come by?
Yeah, I'd love to.
In LA,
great.
Around the time of the premiere?
Yeah, we'll have some with all the new findings.
Yes, yeah. Please.
Very interesting stuff, everybody. I hope you'll spend a part of your weekend in contemplation and do a review and ask yourself, what am I doing every day? Do I do something every day to bring in new earth? Or have I maybe been a little bit lazy and caught up in my life and I'm worried about when I'm going to drink my next cup of cappuccino? Think about it. Have a wonderful weekend. I hope to see you on Monday. Namaste.